has to pay the iron price. He has to pay the iron price.
I'll never respect you while he lives.
Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn, Payne, and Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm bound. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See, as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar, my rulers, all men must die.
Hello and welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television, brought to you by baldmove.com. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And we're here to wrap up season four like a burrito.
Yeah, we are.
Ship it out the door, have you eat it, and hopefully not shit your pants as a direct result. We'll see how it goes. Jim, first of all, let's talk about, we kind of shied away from this last episode.
Okay.
What's your thoughts on season four overall?
I just shit my pants.
Ah, damn it. Well, it was a good shit your pants or was it a bad shit your pants?
It was a good shit your pants, a really good shit in my pants, because season four might have been my favorite season. It was gonzo. It was balls to the wall, action the entire time.
Yeah. I think, as both a book reader and as a fan of the show, that season four is a clear favorite. It's not okay. Like, it doesn't tower over to competition.
And it doesn't have the best moments of the series.
It might not have the individual best moments, yeah. But there's so many iconic moments that hit you one after another, and the pacing is so good that, you know, quibbles here and there for some of the latter half of the season. The first part up through the mountain and the Viper is a freight train of a season.
Yeah, I was reading through some of the synopsis of older episodes from the season, and I couldn't believe how fast it got started. I mean, Joffrey was dead in episode two.
Right. This season's the Hound and Arya had the epic fight in the inn, I think, in the first episode.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just ludicrous levels of action and revelations, and it just seems like every other episode we got something epic or cool or important, or sometimes all three.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where would you rank this amongst the other seasons?
I put it right at the top.
Okay. How would the other seasons then rank?
1-3-2, maybe?
1-3-2?
4-1-3-2?
I'm thinking I'm a 4-3-1-2.
4-3-1-2. Why do you like 3 so much?
It had the build up to the Red Wedding. I feel like
that's
that
true. Yeah,
it was a little bit better pace. I think that there's a clear upgrade in the show's overall look between season one and season three. Season two had the upgraded look, but I think season two is the weak sister.
Yeah.
Which, and that's damning it with harsh praise, actually, because. Uh-huh. Really, the only thing I didn't like about it was Danny's plotline.
Okay, yeah.
And similarly, season three, even though I think it was necessary medicine we take, the Theon stuff was not much fun to have to sit through.
Very true, yeah.
And it was built to conventional. You know, you had the Danny sacking of, what was that, Yunkai?
Mm-hmm.
Or Astapor, 1-2. That was pretty epic. But then there wasn't as many just like balls-to-wall holy shit moments until you got to the Red Wedding, which is one of the ultimates.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I had that majorly spoiled for me.
I think that's,
so that took away from my enjoyment.
Maybe that was one of the other things I enjoyed about season four, the fact that they're always, as a book reader, felt to me like it's kind of like riding the beast at King's Island. This old 35-year-old wooden roller coaster that goes 70 miles an hour, and you're thinking, this is going to be the one where it just flies off into the forest.
Yep.
And you're kind of white-knuckled. I mean, the scene where we went to the Land of Always Winter and saw the ceremony that turns a human baby into a White Walker, holy shit, something I wasn't even on my radar to see.
Yeah.
And there's just constant moments like that where I'm just kind of like, oh my God, are they going to zig and juke where they should have zagged and not juked? I don't know. And I feel like I'm right there at the end of the season, and next season is wide open, full of possibilities while still staying true to the source material. I found it very exciting.
Yeah, from what you said, season four was easily the most departed the show has ever been from the book, right?
Yeah, and I was talking to some fans on email, and they speculated that because HBO renewed, or you basically bought this in a batch. that maybe that gave Benioff and Weiss the courage and the freedom to, like, we're going to do that. We're going to count on having another season, and we're not going to worry about getting this all, you know, lined up perfectly, and we're not afraid to kind of rock the boat with book readers because we've got this. We got next season no matter what happens. Turns out the show's even more wildly popular than it ever was. It doubles in size every season.
I was going to say, really, if they piss off the book readers, are they going to stop watching?
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, it's kind of like what we talked about with Walking Dead. The book readers, believe it or not, a tiny population of the total fan base.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that being said, I really enjoy it. I know a lot of book readers are kind of up in arms now. It'll be interesting to see what they say next season. Especially, what's really interesting in my mind is if George Martin doesn't get The Winds of Winter out before next spring, it's going to be pandafuckingmonium.
Uh-huh.
Because they're so far through some of these plot lines, like particularly Bran and Sansa, they don't really have any book material left. Maybe a little bit for Bran.
Interesting. That's crazy with Sansa because she just seems to be becoming a real character now.
Indeed.
So even in the book, she's not that well fleshed out yet.
And I mean, the way they leave her is just about the way we leave her in the books. And so if he doesn't get The Winds of Winter out, he's going to be forcing the showrunners to, unless we just move away from those plots for a season, which I don't for a minute believe.
Yeah, I mean, you, have to you start move away from Bran for a season, and now he's got a beard. He's now 6'4".
Sure.
it's bad news.
I think that's where, you know, I feel like that a lot of people that are hanging the hopes on, well, maybe they'll do a prequel season, or maybe that's what they forget. They don't have time to stop. They're already losing time with these young actors.
Absolutely.
It's kind of becoming a farce with some of them anyway.
Uh-huh.
They're incredibly lucky that Maisie Williams is you know, her face must go into hyperbolic chamber on the off season or hyperbaric chamber because she's not aging.
She just yeah.
Sophie Turner same way. Didn't get lucky with Isaac Hempstead Wright or whatever his name is, but yeah. He's the Bran. And then Rickon, they could fucking recast Rickon by the next time we see him.
Sure. I don't even know what he looks like.
Yeah, you couldn't pick him out.
No, they could cast...
If I told you that Rickon was secretly the village boy that shot Ygritte, you'd probably believe it.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, that's actually a big hinge moment in Dance of Dragons. You find out he actually was Rickon.
I had no idea.
Smashing walnuts in the background, you never knew. So that's how we felt about the season overall. Is there anything you want to talk about before we get into the differences between books and show section?
Are we going straight from that to feedback. Our feedback? Okay, then I want to talk about a couple of things, like with the way that season four was left.
Okay.
We've seen Arya really grow a lot. And grow might be the wrong word. She has changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if growth is what it is, because now she wants to kill all these people and she can actually do it, or it seems like she can. She's become a lot tougher under the Hound's tutelage. That's kind of an interesting development, and I'm really curious to see where her character goes. I think she's just going to be an awesome killing machine, which I'm totally cool with. Bring on awesome killing Arya.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that I don't... My morality doesn't get its knickers in a twist seeing a 13-year-old girl killing people.
Sure.
What's that Bobcat Goldthwait movie? About
Red State?
I think
that's
Kevin Smith made one. But he made one about a guy that snaps after he watches like American Idol and 16 and pregnant. And he goes on a killing spree with another little girl. Thought that movie was hilarious. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Okay. The other big thing that is kind of left up in the air is, what is the status of the Lannister Empire here? I mean, Tywin's dead.
And by extension, all of Westeros.
Absolutely, yeah. King's Landing, that stuff in particular, it looked like, you know, Tywin is having money troubles. He's setting up this relationship with the Tyrells. Cersei doesn't want that relationship. I guess through Tommen and Margaery, that's going to kind of be continued, because they really need the money from the Tyrells to pay off their debt.
That's the reason they're kind of still in bed with them.
But there's no way Cersei is going to marry Loras now. I mean, she's basically in power at the moment, and she doesn't seem to want that.
The only thing that was going to make her marry him was Tywin.
Yeah.
And Tywin's dead now.
Why would she?
Presumably. Maybe the bells are ringing because everyone is so happy he survived an apparent assassination attempt.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know.
I'm sure. No, you're probably right. big thing left up in the air there. What's the status of King's Landing and the Lannister Empire, period?
And this undoubtedly weakens all of Westeros, removing a competent, powerful, cunning ruler.
Yeah.
And substituting Cersei. I hope that's not too much of a spoil to say there's a little bit of a power vacuum here.
Yeah.
And by the way, winter is still coming.
That's the thing.
Four seasons in, the true threat. Like, we even found this year, the wildlings aren't the true threat.
Not totally.
They're glorified refugees. The true threat has yet to make an appearance. And Westeros keeps getting weaker and weaker.
Yeah.
I mean, think about all those wheat fields on fire when we saw, like, you know, the devastation of the Riverlands and the breadbasket of Westeros.
Mm. Yeah.
And winter is fucking coming.
It's coming, and I feel like there are two waves coming from the north. You've got Roose Bolton. Excuse me. Roose Bolton is kind of in the north. Then you got Stannis, who's up north, and who knows what's going on with him and the 100,000-man Mance Raider army.
Sure.
Do they join up and march south? That's kind of up in the air. We don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a huge threat to King's Landing as well. There's a lot of danger in this empire at the moment.
Sure.
In these Seven Kingdoms. And the other thing that I'm really curious about is to see how Dany progresses from here, because I feel like her season has really been one of kind of a folly of errors. She just, like, continually did what she thought was going to make everything better, and it never worked quite how she expected.
And it's only in hindsight, like, at no time when she was doing these things were we as a viewer like, oh, big fucking mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe a little bit about the staking of the Masters, but still, sure. I think as a viewer, you're like, nah, Grandpa Kingsguard is just too old and out of touch. We need some vengeance for these little girls that were nailed to the crosses.
Uh-huh.
Nailed to the road signs, rather. So, yeah, I think it's kind of brilliant in she's the leader that we wanted to see. And we're being forced to face the consequences of her actions, which are kind of our own.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, she has this visionary outlook on what she's going to do for these people, and it doesn't quite turn out how she expects. And I feel like she's starting to learn those lessons. Yeah. I mean, it first took her advisors to tell her, hey, what you're doing here might not be right, because, look, I'm experienced, I've seen this shit before, you might be messing up. And then it turns out she kind of is messing up.
It also kind of calls into question from it, her inner circle is an aging knight who maybe is not the best barometer for morality. And also, do we have any evidence that he's got a keen tactical mind?
No.
A guy who was so weak that he got into his wife and started selling slaves to finance her spending habits because he couldn't get any control over his own household, who's exiled now. A pirate sellsword maniac.
Yeah.
And a nutless slave who's been brainwashed, and a young slave girl translator. That's her inner circle. Is there anyone that can really right that ship?
I feel like she's going to have to do it herself. And Barristan might, you know, kind of give her a foothold from which to do that, because he does seem to be a bit of a moral compass for her. Not a moral compass. She has a very firm outlook on morality, certainly. But he kind of is trying to temper that with a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of forethought, you know?
All right.
So it'll be interesting. I really want to see where she goes.
Anything else?
I think that's about it. I mean,
I've decided, as I've talked to you, I'm going to restructure this podcast a little bit. There's a few viewer takes that were like wrap-ups of themselves.
Oh, okay.
And I know that there's some people that consider any discussion of book spoilers versus show spoilers to be spoilers, or book differences between show differences to be spoilers de facto. And I want these people to enjoy as much of the podcast as they can before we kick them out.
Okay.
So let's go with a couple listener feedbacks that are kind of wrap-ups onto themselves. Rob M., who is the big proponent of the kill of the week, wants to know, hey, Aaron, how about a top 5 kill of the week /season in the season wrap-up?
Huh.
Here's my list, Jim.
Okay.
I've got a clear number one, and then like a second tier, and then a third tier. And I kind of rated these.
Can we say how you're judging these things?
Yes. I'm rating them on both a spectacular scale and how important they were to the plot.
Okay. I feel like that's fair.
And the top one, because it pegs both meters, is Oberyn.
Yeah.
It turns out that it you know, there's so much, if you didn't know what was coming, so much seemed to hinge on that skull smash.
Yeah.
And it was gruesome, and it was a character that we'd grown to love. Arguably a bigger blow than the Red Wedding, which because, you know, spoilers and whatnot, I think its effect is a little bit muted.
Uh-huh.
That's my clear number one. Any controversy there?
I totally agree with that one.
Number two, Tywin Lannister. Not for spectaculars, but just for sheer importance. Probably the most important death, Tywin Lannister.
Okay, that's my number two as well.
And the fact that he's murdered by his own son that he felt superior to and had rejected and disowned. A lot of pathos there.
Yeah.
I think makes up for some of the lack of the actual physical spectacularness.
Yeah, and being totally deserving of it.
Number three, actually... Number three, I'm going to adjust on the fly, Joffrey.
Oh, you're stealing all of mine, man. That's literally my top three.
All right, sweet.
Yeah.
I think the actual manner of his death was spectacular. The makeup and effects people really sold the awfulness of his death.
Oh, God, yeah.
And his face. Ugh. It did change the power dynamic and the balance of King's Landing.
Completely. Yeah.
And it was so satisfying. Probably the most satisfying death from a fan perspective. I thought... Like, Viserys getting crowned in season one was good.
Mm-hmm.
But Joffrey getting brought down low was, probably, again, the most satisfying death. Number three, or number four, Lyza getting chucked out the old moon door.
I don't know if that'd be my number four. I don't think we agree on whether or not my number four is dead.
Okay, what's your number four?
The Hound.
Mildly interesting.
Okay.
And I don't have... smoking gun evidence for or against Sandor being alive.
He seemed pretty brutally wounded where he was, and he wanted to die. I feel like he's probably dead. So that's my number four, because it was an awesome battle with Brienne that led up to it. It's a pretty important thing for Arya. That'd be my number four. Why don't you talk about
My number four, Lysa, I just thought it was, you know, a lot of book readers lost their shit because instead of saying, you know, I've only loved one woman, instead of saying only Kat, he said your sister.
Uh-huh.
Other than that,
and
a couple other minor details, I thought that was pretty straight out of the book. I thought her getting chucked out the moon door was epic.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it happened right in front of Sansa, and it seemed like the catalyst to turn Sansa into... a quote-unquote interesting character, although we've got an excellent reader feedback on this. I thought that's very momentous and very well done. Number five, Polliver, who you'll recall is the shit that kind of started the chicken fight in the bar, and Arya stabbed him through his neck with needle. That kind of sent her on her more badass trajectory.
Yeah,
it was the first, I believe, overt act of vengeance she directly took, and not through some other person like the Hound. Or she did stab a bunch of Frey soldiers, I guess. But this is the first kind of name she notched off all by herself, and it was gruesome, and it made me cheer. So there's that. You have a different top five?
That's a good one. Fifth one. I think my fifth one. That's tough. Lies is a good one.
Honorable mentions. You want me to go over that and see if any of them?
I wish I cared more about Ygritte, because that would have been my number five. But I really don't care.
Ygritte got an honorable mention, and yes, so did Grin.
How about Carl?
Carl the Fucking Legend did get an honorable mention.
That was pretty fucking cool. I mean, Jon Snow stabs him right through the mouth.
True.
Or not Jon Snow. Jon Snow stabs him. Yeah. And then the other girl he was saving stabs him right through his mouth.
Gave him a steel tongue.
Yeah, that was sweet.
The Fucking Legend of Gin Alley. Champion of Marine, the guy who pissed in front of Danny and then got pissed on in return by Dario Nyquilus.
Uh-huh.
The peasant prisoner that got bisected by the mountain, spilled his guts on the ground.
How about Sam's friend?
Pip and Grin.
Pip, yep. Got it through the neck.
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought Steer, the Magnar Thin, who is the big bald mute dude, or not mute guy, yeah. Cannibal.
Yeah.
Hammered. Got hammered. Got Fargoed. Mm-hmm. That was gruesome. Anything I missed? Oh, the Giant's archery target. They got shot clean off the wall. I thought that was pretty badass. Fucking badass, too.
Yeah, so many deaths in this season.
Oh, yeah. Jojen?
That's right. That Jojen stupid kid pasted? Died. Yeah.
That didn't peg my give a shit needle is the problem. No, and it wasn't especially. I mean,
they didn't show the neck slit.
Having a ice skeleton cool. repeatedly gut you with a knife, it would probably be pretty brutal to live through.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I liked his death. I thought it was. When the skeleton just kept stabbing him over and over again, I was like, oof.
Have you seen the Beautiful Yuck. Death series?
No.
There's this guy, and I don't know if
the series yeah. of posters? Those are super cool. Yeah, I have seen them.
We got to get some of those for a studio. And I'm not sure if they're official HBO or if it's just some guy doing it, but I will link to it in our show notes.
I know
it's
HBO has them on their site, and they always link to them.
It's a series of 40 posters that are done in this like very cool graphic style that illustrates almost every important death that's occurred in the series so far.
Yeah, if you think of like Ollie Moss, that it kind of reminds me a little bit of his stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But like a little more colorful.
Yeah.
More saturated, I guess.
It's just really, really fucking cool the way. And sometimes like I just noticed when the one for Robert Baratheon, mm-hmm. where it's just kind of like this forest scene and with a little bit of blood in it, but then if you notice like the hill that there's it's taking place on, it's actually in the it's a very loose outline of a pig, a boar.
Nice.
I'm like, man, they're just really clever that way.
Yeah.
So I will link those in the show notes and you guys should check it out. It's awesome. A couple things to clear up. Inver M. Did Brienne eat Hot Pie's direwolf pie or did it go bad before she got to Arya or what the fuck? That's a good point. You think she could just flash to direwolf pie and be like, you know, that would settle all questions for Arya. I don't think the Hound would play along.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's kind of curious that she didn't even try.
I assume they ate it. It's a long journey. Pod. Yeah. Pod just ate it.
Pod, God damn it, Pod. You ate the direwolf. She's like, Pod, give me the direwolf.
Face off.
And Pod just kind of looks at the ground and kicks the dirt. And she's like, really, you ate the fucking direwolf cake?
Well, I saved his haunches.
Now that he ate it in such a way that now it looks like a lion.
He ate a mane around
his head.
Son
of a bitch. Yeah. She's like, you got the Lannister steel.
And that would have been really hilarious. She whips out the direwolf pie right. and it's a lion.
Oh, my God.
And the Hound just goes at her.
He also asks, wasn't Mance Rayder one of the five kings in the War of Kings? Now it seems like he just wants shelter south of the wall. The fuck is going on here? No, you misunderstood. He actually is the king beyond the wall that nobody south of the wall
gives a shit about.
No one south of the neck, which is the southernmost part of the Northern Empire,
that's
even knows he exists.
The moat that they took.
Moat Cailin is where, you know, Westeros is kind of like a peanut-shaped continent, and that's like the neck. The neck is the waist of the peanut.
Okay.
No one even knows about him or gives a shit. The War of Five Kings was Joffrey, Rob Stark, Stannis, Renly, and Balon Greyjoy. Those are the five kings, canonical five kings of the war.
Okay.
What do you make of the stare down between the Red Woman and Jon Snow? Does she see royal blood in him? More leeches, please. What do you make of that?
She probably does smell that royal blood. She was pretty keen on that with the what other guy.
What
she
royal
took
blood
leeches?
Does he have, though? I mean, other than the Starks of old.
Yeah.
I mean, do
good
they
point.
Count that? Although.
It's a long trace back.
Yeah. I mean, if they're going royal blood, considering, like, you know, Robert's bastard child, maybe that's if Gendry's got royal blood in him, then maybe Jon does through the old king of the north.
I think it was
300
more
year old
just
royal blood.
Honest.
How old? What's the expiration date on royal blood?
I don't know. Good question.
Typical Game of Thrones messing with viewers, albeit not killing any favorite characters. We got a line from the Three Eyed Raven, old dude from The Last Crusade. You're going to get back the thing you most want. You mean I'm going to walk again? Nope. Doesn't mean he would warg into a flying creature, i.e. dragon. Lots
that would be fucking cool.
Lots of feedback about people making that connection between flying and dragon. I can't say not because I don't know, or not because I can't tell, because that's an open question. Mm-hmm. It's a very popular book theory.
How about
Bran is going to be involved in? He's going to be a dragon rider via remote control telepathy.
Or he could just go full Atreyu, never ending story style, and ride Falgor into King's Landing.
Drogon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that'd be sweet too. Just saddle up.
Okay. All right.
He's been riding Hodor the entire time. Why not?
Well, you know, there's the kind of a parallel between the How You Train Your Dragons, where the kid lost his leg, and the fact that, you know, in the first season, Tyrion made this elaborate saddle that would allow him to ride a horse.
Yeah.
Tyrion's now disgraced, and he's heading over to Essos. Is there, you know, is there going to be some... That's another popular theory, that this is going to be a meeting of the minds where it's going to be everybody against the Westerosi establishment plus the White Walkers, and Tyrion and Bran and Dany are all going to be aligned. Again, I'm not spoiling anything. Yeah. This is just speculation based on what we've caught up with so far.
That's a lot of different, people with the same goal coming together. But I mean, even if they did come together and take King's Landing, then they got to fight it out to see who actually sits on the throne, right? Stannis is not going to let Dany sit on the throne, and vice versa.
It depends, because that's another open question. How happy will George R.R. Martin allow this ending to be? Will it be a fairy tale ending?
I wouldn't bet on that.
Where, like, Dany marries somebody we like, and they live happily ever after, and they share, you know, a peaceful rule of the kingdom. Everyone that we care about going to die?
Could be.
And there's going to be an epilogue where we have a glimmer of hope that maybe Rickon is up in as King of the North, and maybe Tommen's still ruling King of the South because he seems like a good boy, and it's the boy kings that worked. I mean, or one thing that I'm kind of hot on right now is the fact that this will end the Iron Throne in Westeros, and after this this winter coming, that it'll fracture back into the Seven Kingdoms, and they'll have an uneasy, you know, it basically returns things to before the conquest of the original Aegon.
Sure.
Who the hell knows? I mean, there's at least 3 seasons and 2 books left.
There's also the wild card of the Dorne.
The Dornish, yeah.
Yeah, the Dornish Empire seems like it could be really, really important coming up, considering, you know, they're the ones that fought off the dragons before. Dany has dragons. There's going to be a clash between those two empires at some point.
He also wants to know, is the Hound dead? Is Sir Alistair dead? We didn't see him in the fire. What is your opinion, Jim? You think the Hound's dead?
I think the Hound's dead. I don't think Sir Alistair's dead.
Okay. I don't know. I can't say about Sir Alistair. I don't know.
Okay.
Either way. And the Hound, I don't know conclusively either way as well.
I know nothing. You know nothing, Aaron.
I don't. Sheen wants to know, hey guys, can you explain a few things for me? Where were the rest of the giants riding mammoths when Stannis shows up? To me, a giant on a mammoth could have run through a bunch of mountain knights.
True.
We talked about this, and we're trying to think, like, what a giant on a mammoth equals about how many mounted knights.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like the answer is infinite.
No.
I feel like somewhere between 10 and 50 knights could easily take down a giant and a mammoth. And they're just not that many giants and mammoths.
I mean, if you look at it, 5 dudes took down a giant who got stuck in a grate.
True.
Coming through a tunnel.
And close quarters. And
so
No mammoth.
They're not
rider.
That strong, right? Yeah.
No, I mean, that's the thing. They're not fucking the Incredible Hulk. They're flesh and blood creatures that can be killed with lances and spears and stuff like that. So, yeah. He also says, who takes out the guards that were lying on the ground outside of Tyrion's cell? Was it a one-armed Jaime?
Could be.
I feel like that it was a Jaime Varys alliance, probably some potions involved. I don't have any. That's just kind of my assumption. And how did the whites outside the tree entrance turn skeletal when they were buried under ice? Shouldn't the ice have preserved their bodies? Bogman style. My answer is magic. Jim, what's your answer?
That's a perfect answer. That covers everything.
Another thing is, I don't think that this is quite the land of always winter. Like, this is very much up in Alaska, kind of, where in the height of summer, it probably gets marshy and kind of, you know, mushy tundra, and there's bacteria and things. And I don't know. I thought that they were trying to tell us that this was a very ancient cache of bodies, like maybe from the war, original war, the first men versus, it could be thousands of years old.
That's what it felt like, yeah.
And it's all these freezing and thawing cycles that, and there's other evidence. The fact that someone said in an email, I think, or maybe I read this online, that the knife that Jojen was being stabbed with was bronze. Was another indication we know in Westeros proper they've moved on to steel and whatnot, but iron is, you know, bronze is a very Bronze Age.
Yeah.
Another showing how old these bodies might be.
I wonder if there are any like house symbols or anything on their armor or.
I don't know. I'll have to wait for the Blu-rays on that one. All right, so here's the point in the podcast where we're going to do book differences to show differences. I know a lot of people think that these are de facto spoilers. I'm of the opinion that, first of all, I've edited them. If there is anything that might give us a little bit too much information, I've kicked that out, and I've mostly talked about that stuff in the spoiler sections of their respective cast. But it seems like it generates good fodder, and we can have a debate about who did a scene better, the books or the show, and you know, what do the differences maybe tell us about how they're going to resolve things, or there's background information that might help you appreciate the series more. But I understand if you think that's a spoiler, and have a great off season. We'll see you here next spring for season 5 of Game of Thrones. And we're also going to trek on with these differences. 401 Two Swords. One difference is the Thins are not actually cannibals in the books. The Thins are one of the more advanced wildling tribes. They actually have learned to forge and smelt bronze themselves. They have a kind of hierarchical structure as far as lords and kings and whatnot, similar to they're the most south of the wall type people in the Wilding Empire.
Okay.
There is Ice River clans who are cannibals. Why do you think that they kind of combined, they took the name Thin and gave it to the cannibals? Why make these guys cannibals? I guess that's a big question.
It certainly made them seem more menacing. I don't know that if they had just been wielding bronze weapons, I would have been as scared of them as I am knowing that they're going to eat the dead.
I think
like,
also
I'm going to eat your mother and your father.
Right. It preserves the surprise that, well, and then again, this is if we believe him, it preserves the surprise that Mance Rayder actually doesn't want to conquer Westeros. He just kind of wants to get his people out. This isn't conquest. This is more of a refugee. So sending the more savage contingent down there to fuck shit up in the south delays that realization towards the end.
Okay. Sure.
The interrogation of Jon takes place later in the novels. In fact, when Jon arrives at Castle Black, both Ser Alistair and Lord Janos were not even present. They were over at another castle, Eastwatch by the Sea.
That would have been nice.
not having them.
Alistair there, yeah.
Well, I mean, so why do you think, because they had the acting position, was one of the head stewards, and then later Donald Noyle, who was the head smith. Why do you think that they kind of brought these antagonists over early to have him kind of hounding Jon Snow throughout the season?
Well, I need a question answered in order to formulate a thought on that. Do they go to Craster's Keep in the book? And is there the problem of, oh, God, the people at Craster's Keep know that we only have 100 and something guys?
They do not.
That's probably why. They were adding that arc. They needed time to get up there. And this is kind of the impetus for that, right? Like, he's interrogated. He says, look, there's a whole bunch of dudes coming down. And that kind of sets up later when he says we need to go north because he finds out.
Sure. We'll talk about a little bit of that. We'll talk a little more about that later. Okay. Dantos gives Sansa a hairnet in the Book of Clash of Kings, not a necklace. Kind of like a veil style. I like this change.
Okay.
The necklace just looked cooler. A fucking hairnet.
But there's a hairnet with jewels that
it's a jeweled hairnet.
It's taken off and poisoned, Joffrey, the same way?
It's exactly the same, except for it's a necklace versus a hairnet.
Yeah. Yeah, a necklace just looks cooler. I'm with you.
Brianna Tarth, Jaime Lannister do not arrive at King's Landing in time for the royal wedding. Some of the scenes from from Jaime's scenes did occur, but much later after his return. There is no direct talking of Jaime with Joffrey ever. Did you like the fact that they got a little bit of awkward father-son time and there's a little bit
of
awkward... I do, too. I felt like this was a very positive change.
And it set up that triple triangle, right? The triangle between Jaime, Brienne, and Cersei.
That
kind of while the wedding was going on. I thought that was brilliant.
Certainly, there's in the books, I definitely think there's that triangle there, except for Cersei's ignorant of it. And then that's me. Like I said, I ship Brienne and Jaime in some capacity.
Me too, yeah. But it sounds like it happens after the wedding. I think mixing it up with the wedding is more interesting.
Yeah, oh, for sure. For sure. Especially for through film when you're not allowed to just see Jamie's dreams and his thoughts and Brienne's dream. I mean, that it's a definitely great way when you're not limited to POV and their internal thoughts. It's a great way to put on screen. So I liked it. Mm-hmm. Oberyn's host arrives at King's Landing before the Red Wedding and basically stiffs Tyrion. In the books, Oberyn's actually there and they meet outside the city and they do all that speechifying there. And the books, he blows them off and goes right to the brothel. I thought that was a shorthand way of showing how kind of insolent and lecherous, gotcha. And also establishes by a show not tell how much he hates the Lannisters before he actually then explains it. So sure. I didn't have a problem with that.
I like it.
It's never in the books. The whole Grey Worm Miss Andy thing does not exist. She's only 10 years old in the books. Number one.
Oh Jesus.
Yeah.
That's Danny's different.
Danny's 13. So.
She definitely doesn't seem 13 in the show.
You don't say.
So are those characters still connected at all? Are the characters even in the books?
Sure. Both of them? Both of those are characters in the books.
Huh. It seems like that fills them out and makes them actual characters as opposed to, you know, ex-slaves.
Yeah, and it just depends on where they go. I feel like I'm not for or against this until I see how it develops.
And I'm super curious about the Pillar and Stone stuff. Like, how does that all fit with the type of relationship they're developing?
Yeah, like what kind? It's clearly some sort of romantic relationship because we speculated maybe it's a brother-sister thing.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to be true.
Yeah, because there was a part in the books where Miss Sandy talks about her slave brother, and I thought, well, maybe they'll bring it around. No, they're not bringing it around. Hmm. But what does a romantic relationship between a slave girl, former slave girl, and a current eunuch slave soldier look like? And I think that could be fascinating and also could be god-awful bad.
Sure.
And I could see it going either way. Because I have faith in the double D's, but they do fuck stuff up. Mm-hmm. Case in point, Cersei Jaime, which we'll be talking about next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Grey Worm and Dario Nyquilus never gamble with the swords, the feats of strength.
Oh, okay. That's minor.
Yeah, it's kind of dopey. I thought it both made him look stupid and made
a little bit.
It's little teenage high school romance stuff, but whatever. In the TV series, both Arya and the Hound survive the fight in the end, but in the books, the Hound is severely wounded and his injury begins to fester. This is the point where Arya abandons the Hound as per his urging. In the series, this scene is postponed to the season's climax, where he's mortally wounded and hit off a cliff during a fight with Brienne of Tarth. It's hard to argue that we'd be better off missing the Hound and Arya roadshow throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to argue that him being wounded at this battle at the inn is superior to him and Brienne meeting and beating the shit out of each other, which never happens in the books. But that was so awesome. I can't complain.
Yeah, I have had zero complaints about Arya and the Hound this entire season.
Right.
It's been great.
Because in the books, Brienne just kind of fucks around.
Oh, yeah?
They got this really weird strategy where she's off in search, you know, just kind of like she's gone off in search of Sansa, but she doesn't know where Sansa's at. And okay. And we know where Sansa's at because she's at the Eyrie with Littlefinger. And it's somehow, even though she's got no way to know this, she just has this goes-nowhere storyline.
At least they gave us Podrick tell her where she is.
Probably. Right. And the fact that she had a clear mission to go send that, and they met up with the Hound, and they met up with Hot Pie, which doesn't happen, it gave her a lot more things to do. That maybe arguably make more sense than the books. And I still think they can merge this easily with where the action is in the books.
I can see where they had to kind of make some stuff up for her because last season was so interesting with her and Jaime.
Sure.
Their little roadshow.
And splitting them up is just...
It's made her less of a character, I think. You know, I mean, she's still awesome, no doubt, and she's still got that history that she has built up through her relationship with Jaime, but I think that relationship was so interesting, you take that away now.
Right. Brienne's a great character. Jaime's a great character. Exactly. But they're peanut butter and chocolate. Brienne and Pod are not... Their chemistry is almost purely comedic.
Yes.
In the books, in the series, and that's not as good as Gwendolyn and Nicolaj going head-to-head.
And it's not as good as Arya and the Hound, which kind of stole the show.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Moving on to 402, Lion and the Rose. In the books, Joffrey shows no sign of gratitude towards his uncle Tyrion's wedding present, which is the illustrated history of the kings. Instead, he just basically turns it into another insult for Sansa and Tyrion. I kind of actually like the fact that they rope-a-doped this with him being stately for once to just later hack the book to pieces.
Yeah, and it shows his total disregard for any kind of wisdom.
No, it's the equivalent of a rich teenager getting a Gutenberg Bible.
Yeah, an original printing.
And then someone gives him an AK-47 and he just shoots it up.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the way they portrayed it in the show because it was kind of like, God, wow, that's super douchey.
It reminds me of the Jay-Z song where he's talking about letting his daughter play with his paintings. It's like, yeah, that's yours. Go ahead and do whatever you want with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving on to Joffrey. He did arrange. There's the War of the Five Kings was something that is invented for the show where they had the five dwarves in the books. It was basically he had two dwarves jousting on pigs.
Okay.
Same deal. It was largely an insult aimed solely at Tyrion. I like the fact that by making it the War of the Five Kings, you got to mortify Margaery and Olenna and Loras. And make Tywin uncomfortable, and insult Sansa. Like half the people we cared about were sick about this performance. I thought that was brilliant.
Yep.
Apparently, Benioff and Weiss wanted to do it like the books, but they started inquiring, and the agency that's responsible for ensuring the humane treatment of animals says you can't have actors riding pigs. And that made him think outside the box of what they could do. And I think it was actually superior. It
worked really well.
Rather than Bronn, Jaime has Sir Ilyn Payne, who is the guy, the mute Lannister that took the head off of Ned Stark in the first season, to train him in the use of his left hand, largely because Payne had his tongue removed by the Mad King Aerys and he can't speak or write. The reason that this happened is because in real life, the actor that portrayed Ilyn Payne has had a tragic, valiant fight with cancer, and he was unable to do the filming. That's a bummer, and that's sad, but I like Jaime and Bronn together.
I do, too. I like it a lot because their personalities really clash.
Like Jamie's thinks he's an arch smart ass. and then he meets Bronn and like Bronn is able to get under his skin. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And Jamie's been, you know, shut down as far as, his power goes. He's now kind of at the mercy of Bronn. I like that a lot. That kind of hasn't gone anywhere though. Right. I mean, Jamie hasn't had any epic battles where he's learned from Bronn how to actually fight with his left hand. Bronn and him didn't square down in the trial by combat, which I was hoping to see. That hasn't really gone anywhere, and I'm hoping it does next season.
All right, mildly interesting. We'll move on. Jaime and Brienne didn't attend the wedding because they actually didn't make it to King's Landing until after Joffrey's death.
Okay.
I liked all the scenes with them, so I'm in favor of. I actually feel like. Yeah, that this is a theme that I feel like that the Double D's fixed a lot of awkward timing issues that was in Martin's original work. And there's only really one casualty, and that was Jaime's and Cersei's relationship, and I think that's just a fucked up piece of film.
Yeah, and they're probably doing a lot to make this into a television show, to adapt it.
Yep.
Like you said, you can't really do narration in somebody's head, so you've got to do a lot of stuff to show rather than tell, and that's some of the changes we see, I'm sure.
Roose Bolton does not smuggle himself and his wife into the north to reach the Dreadfort. He remained with his main army, which had marched north from the Twins, but he couldn't get past the moat. In the series, Roose must have circumvented... So they never meet until after Theon takes the Dreadfort. Or no, I'm sorry.
Wow,
after,
okay.
After Ramses...
So he's not sent on a mission to take Moat Cailin.
I like the scene between Ramsay and Roose, and I think it was, again, an approved timing challenge. Although they just made it up. I mean, it's like he just smuggled himself across. I thought that was kind of brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Ramsay's hunt of the girl in the woods is actually a significantly toned-down version of a pastiche of things from the books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's Ramsay's a fucking sick bastard in the books.
I mean, I get it. In the show, he's a sick bastard.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But you're telling me he's worse?
Yeah. Like, Yeah, I don't even want to. I don't even want to talk okay. about it.
Yep.
In the TV series, Ramsay has a friendship with Locke over their shared sadism. In the books, this doesn't happen because Locke is an invented character.
Hmm.
He's kind of takes okay. a lot of role of this Vargo Hoat character, but you know, I don't think that's a major point. And I thought Vargo is a silly character in the book because he talks with this outrageous lisp, and he's an idiot.
Hmm.
Okay. Having Locke be a smart guy who's just kind of cruel and likes fucking with Jamie, I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
In the books, you like this, Jim. Jamie's hand actually is made of solid gold.
All right, that sweet Lannister gold.
Gold-plated steel. I just think it's like, how heavy must that be? To be at the very end of your arm? My God. In the books, Tywin wasn't warned about Cersei finding that, or Tyrion, rather, wasn't warned about Cersei finding out about Shae.
Hmm.
Therefore, there was not an arrangement for her being shipped away to Pintos. Do you have any thoughts or opinions? This is kind of overall a symptom of how they soften Shae's character. In the book, she's portrayed as a gold-digging whore.
Okay. Not here.
In the show, it seems like her feelings for Tyrion are genuine, if not naive.
Sure.
Got a good take on that as well in the feedback section. There's a bunch of minor differences about in this the season. The series showed the breakfast and the wedding taking place outside, where there are various indoor locations.
Okay.
So here's in the books, the indoor locations are kind of dark and brooding. You know, like the throne room, etc. This is lit by torchlight. Happens at night. In the books, it's a very outdoor, airy, and bright. Thematically, which do you prefer? Dark deeds happening in a brightly lit area, or dark deeds happening in a dungeon-like atmosphere?
There's definitely something to be said for the juxtaposition of the bright atmosphere with the things that are actually happening.
Right.
So I would be interested to see something like that in the show.
Okay. Final difference, as he chokes to death, Joffrey gruesomely claws at his throat in a desperate bid to get air, leaving bloody gashes in his neck and his face.
Okay, whatever.
In the TV series, he just kind of chokes and turns purple.
So?
Okay, I just wondered if
yeah.
Because some people were of the thought that he didn't die a hideous enough death. And the book, it was a little bit more hideous.
His face swelled up all purple and his veins popped out and it was pretty gross.
All right, moving on, 403 Breaker of Chains. Tywin never talks to Tommen about the qualities of a good king in the books. There's that scene is invented. You like that change?
I love that change.
I think that's one of the best scenes in this particular episode. So, yeah,
absolutely.
I definitely like that change. First thing Jaime does when he returns to King's Landing is go to Great Sept of Baelor. As he arrived after Joffrey's death, and then they have sex, which was a lot more consensual in the books. It's still coercive, but there's not her sobbing and saying no, no as she's driven to the floor.
Yeah, yeah.
We've talked a bunch about this. I don't think there's any way to reconcile it with the view that the filmmakers had on it. So this is the one awkward part, because that's the first time she sees Jamie and she's very honestly happy. Where in this, it's like they've had a couple weeks to kind of fester in their relationship and her to brood and say you were too late.
Huh.
And as a result, the sex scene just didn't work on any level the way they intended it to. Let's see. John never proposes to march on Craster's Keep to deal with the mutineers.
Okay.
Because by the time that all happens, the Free Folk and the Thins have already begun their southern assault on Castle Black. Sam never sends Gilly to Molestown because Sam and Gilly were still traveling north of the Wall.
Yeah, that seems like a delay, right? That's just...
Mm-hmm.
We need something for Sam to do here, so let's send him off to Molestown.
In fact, the Night's Watch in the books, they had recruited most of the able-bodied men from Molestown to boost their numbers, and it wasn't quite as a one-sided fight in the books as it was in the television show. In the books, the hero of Meereen faces off against this character called Strong Belwas, which is a Dothraki pit-fighting slave who's this enormously fat dude.
Okay.
And the guy... The guy goes down similarly, where the guy ends up getting drug off his horse and he beheads him. But Belwas, in response, shits on the corpse in front of the city instead of pisses. He like one ups the pissing.
Oh boy!
A lot of book readers upset that Strong Belwas didn't get into the show.
Hmm.
You can't show a man shitting on a corpse on television, right?
On HBO, maybe. Maybe. But I feel like it helps Dario's character that he was able to take this guy down and impress
because Dario,
Danny.
New Dario was as a fiasco up to this point.
Yes.
And he's still kind of a fiasco. But
that helped a lot.
This gave him a little bit of his badass swagger back.
For sure.
Let's see. Danny doesn't order the chains and cause the freed slaves to be fired over the walls of Marine because she didn't have any siege implements in the forest.
Just
because
she couldn't.
Yeah, so there's that. Davos doesn't write to the Iron Bank requiring financial aid, nor does he suggest hiring the Golden Company.
Really?
In the books...
That's a huge deal.
In the books, the Iron Bank comes to Stannis because...
The Lannisters aren't paying their debts.
Exactly.
Oh, shit.
So is that better or worse? The fact that the Iron Bank that takes the scene of him kind of groveling before Braavos
and convincing them.
I don't know whether that's better or worse. It just is.
Yeah, that's hard to say. I'm with you. It's okay either way.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Tywin never speaks in private with Oberyn about Ilya's murder. I, you know, having those two have screen time together, I'm not going to argue against.
Sure.
In the book, it's kind of like Oberyn puts all this stuff together, the champion thing, all that stuff. There's no quid pro quo.
So he's not on the judging council?
He is.
Because he was inconsequential on that council. Yeah. I mean, it never even went down to a vote.
Right. 404 Oathkeeper, that whole Missandei teaching Grey Worm is invented. Yeah.
Okay.
Which that fits them having this little romance plot. There's no conversation overt between Olenna and Margaery in the gardens, where she kind of outlines the plot and the whole her marrying a Targaryen, all that. It's
a pep talk.
Yeah.
For Margaery.
For one thing, neither of these characters are point of view characters, so there would be no one around to overhear this comment. also, the whole mystery about who killed Joffrey lasts a lot longer in the books because you don't have these overt scenes. I kind of feel like that's better.
I think maybe, the book. I felt like it happened a little too quickly. And we kind of already knew, but it was nice to have the doubt. Like, who did this? Did Tywin do this? Because there was a lot of evidence pointing to Tywin actually being the culprit.
In the books, Lady Olenna does not leave the capital city after Joffrey's death, but she also isn't a huge character, so I don't have a problem with her. I felt like that made... it more interesting that Margaery kind of stands on her own. She has never grandma propping her up.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Pounce, which is the kitten of Tommen, was one of three black kittens given to him by Margaery as gifts. Because in the book, Tommen's like 9 years old.
Okay.
So it's even creepier than her sneaking in his bedroom and seducing him as a 14, 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So she gives him kittens as a way, you know, kittens and candy are the way you win a 9-year-old's heart.
Sure.
So I thought that was a wink to the book readers, and still, I do like the fact that she's just, you know, again, Margaery Tyrell is not something a teenage boy is equipped to handle.
Not at all.
And
not on any level.
I really like that, and I'm interested in seeing where this goes going forward.
Mm-hmm.
In the books, Podrick doesn't get assigned to Brienne as some kind of, like, parting gift. They meet up later because Podrick wants to find Tyrion and clear his name after the whole unpleasantness.
So does Tyrion still send him away, but just
on
his own?
Tyrion runs off from the capital, and Podrick's left holding his dick.
Oh, okay.
So he finds Brienne and kind of his partners with her organically. I don't think that's better or worse. I actually like, it's kind of sweet that Tyrion was trying to look after him.
Yeah.
In that way. Sam never revealed to Jon that Bran was beyond the wall. In the book, he has to promise that he wouldn't, and he keeps that promise. In the books, in the show, he's like, yeah, your brother's alive, and he's north of the wall. This is a consequence of the whole Craster's Keep business, which we'll get to shortly.
Okay.
And then, of course, Bran never goes across, comes across Craster's Keep, and they're thus not captured, which will set up other differences. 405, first of his name, Peter has Sansa pose as his bastard daughter, not his niece. Minor change, and I think it's more in line to our sensibilities. Her posing as his bastard daughter makes things way creepier than the niece somehow. Lysa and Peter got married at his shitty old ancestral keep in the Fingers, not at the Eyrie. Don't give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
Lysa only reveals that she's the one that killed John Arryn much later in the books, and Sansa wasn't present when it happened. I don't mind that change.
I don't know what ramifications
I don't
that has throughout the series.
It makes Sansa more aware of how awful her aunt is, maybe?
A little bit, yeah.
Lysa's much less kind of big sister with Sansa in the book. She's more overtly, you're a threat and you scare me and I want you dead from the get jump.
Okay.
Robin is never made aware that Sansa is related to him. So that's a big change that might have repercussions in the future. Don't know because it didn't happen in the book. Gold mines of Westeros had not run dry. They're as prosperous as ever. Lannisters, in fact, the majority of the debt the crown owes to the, anyone is to the Lannisters. Lannisters are still rich bitches in the book. That's
really?
A huge change.
That's massive, yeah.
And I wonder why they did it.
So my big question is, why do the Lannisters want to get together with the Tyrells then? Because the whole impetus for that in the series is for them to pay off their debts through the Tyrell wealth.
I think it's because the Lannisters have done the bulk of the fighting for the crown, and they are, and also they're part of the crown, the Westerlands and the Riverlands, which are the traditional, you know, food supplying places of Westeros, got decimated, where the Tyrells, their army is mostly unscratched and their lands unspoiled. Tywin needs them not for their gold, but for their men and the mouths they can feed.
Okay.
And this, I feel like that's a little bit too complicated to explain. So they just made Tywin broke to be like, well, there you go. There's a reason.
Yeah, that works for me.
Ghost came back to Jon much later in the books, and he did not kill anybody at Craster's Keep. Why do you think they did this whole Craster's Keep business? We have Bran and Jon almost meet.
I really don't know. That is the one thing that kind of feels wrong about this season.
Yeah.
Like, the whole pacing with the wall stuff just feels wrong to me. And I don't know if it's because they took such a large deviation in other parts, in other people's storylines, that they had to do something different up here.
So here's the thing. This is maybe the potential biggest spoiler I'm about to, but I don't see it ever coming back into the series.
Okay.
There's this character named Cold Hands in the books who is a white, but
okay.
He's an intelligent, benevolent white.
Oh, Jesus. Where's he at?
He's north of the way. He identifies as a ranger from long ago who died and meets Bran just at the, helps him get through the wall at the Knight's Castle and then guides him to the One-Eyed Raven.
Okay.
And it's kind of his guide of where you're going and who you're supposed to meet with. Whereas in the series, they completely deleted this character.
They put in Jojen.
And no, they gave Bran the ability to mind meld with trees be guided directly by the Three-Eyed Crow.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of fans, book fans, wanted to see Cold Hands because he's kind of a cool character and he gives us a different view of whites.
I like the idea that the whole winter force up there is just very mysterious. I don't know that I want to, humanize them in any way.
Plus,
until maybe later when we have to, but.
There's a couple popular theories about the Cold Hands character. One, that he's actually Benjen Stark.
Okay.
You know, the one that's been
missing
since season
those
one.
Many, many children of the... No.
He's Jon's uncle, who first recruited into the Night's Watch. Then he vanished, and we haven't seen him since.
Okay.
I don't believe that because it kind of doesn't jive with his whole ancient status. Two is that he's actually a white that's being controlled by the Three-Eyed Crow. The Third Eye Blind.
And the Three-Eyed Raven is the old guy in the tree?
Old Twisty Roots guy.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, he seems pretty powerful. He could do both at once, right?
Yeah, I mean, so again, it's cool, but really his whole purpose... And so in the books, you're kind of never sure whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. Because on the one hand, he's helping Bran, but on one hand, he's white. One of the big divisive things is he goes to Craster's Keep and murders all the mutineers. And Bran follows him with Summer, and sees this. He sees him murdering all these Night's Watch guys. And the guy comes out and Bran confronts him. And you think, well, maybe this is a bad guy. And he's like, and Cold Hand says, nope, they were foes. And we know as the book readers, that was kind of like our wink that like this guy is actually all right, because we knew that they were just the mutineers and they were Rast and the Fookin legend of Jyn Ally, and he disposed of them.
Yeah.
Whereas from Bran's perspective, this guy's killing black brothers. What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of cool, creepy things with him, but I can't say that the series was materially hurt by his being omitted.
No, and I don't like what that would have done to the White Walkers, honestly.
Yeah.
In my mind.
It muddles things a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
So, moving on to 406, The Laws of God and Men. Overall, very faithful episode to the source material, but as we mentioned, Stannis never went to Braavos. In fact, he meets with the Iron Bank much later in the series.
See, I like that Stannis did go to Braavos, because it cements Braavos and the Iron Bank as a place to me. Like, before, it was just a concept. It's like, there's this bank out there that's doing things.
Sure.
Who knows where?
Sure.
And now I know exactly where it is. I know what it looks like. It's a cemented
place on the map
in my head. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. I find it hard to argue that this is a worse way to treat it. The Greyjoy forces never attacked a Dreadfort to free Theon. Yara/Asha never came and tried to free Theon.
Okay. It didn't go anywhere, who gives a fuck, right?
I kind of wonder, was that only to keep Asha/Yara
in the story?
In the viewers' minds, and if so, for what purpose?
Yeah, yeah. It seemed pointless.
Yeah, as a book reader, again, it's like, what the fuck? I don't know. Jaime never agrees to leave the Kingsguard and marry in order to have Tyrion spared. In fact, Jaime and Tywin never speak to each other again after Jaime decides to stay in the Kingsguard, as he's disowned like permanently.
That kind of almost feels more right,
yeah.
Honestly. Tywin, yes, it was very subtle the way he said it, like a man with a family, no family in one hand needs
certainly
all the advantages he can get, but then that leaves a lot of stuff unsaid between Jaime and Tywin that I liked.
It does make Tywin really, a more calculated character, because in the books, it was his plan all along to spare Tyrion by sending him to the Black.
See, and we don't know that in the show.
It's
until
hinted,
Jaime and him talk.
I think it's there as subtext, because he's like, done. You know,
yeah.
Oh, you're going to give me what I want anyway and do what I want you to do? So
yep.
I feel like then that's kind of a nod to book readers. But yeah, I know. I don't think it's a destructive change, but slightly weaker than in the books.
How did they convey that plan in the books? Was it all a running thing in Tywin's head? Did we get narration?
No, he's not a POV. He's not a POV. I think it's something that maybe, I think Kevin Lannister, who we've seen before, very minorly in the books. He's been in Tywin's war councils and two separate occasions. He's Kevin's, he's Tywin's brother, younger brother, and Jaime's uncle.
Okay.
And Tyrion's uncle. He actually is the go-between between Tyrion. Because again, Jaime doesn't show up until later.
Yeah.
So it's Kevin going to the prison and saying all these things to Tyrion. And I think Tyrion at one point is like, yeah, my father's going to kill me. And Kevin's like, are you fucking kidding me? Do you think Tywin's going to let blah, blah, blah? So
they actually, let me get this straight.
Yep.
The Double D's took the characters in the book and they pared them down. And this is what we're left with.
Yeah.
Like, let's take Kevin. Let's get him out of here. Let's put this all on Jaime.
They love doing that. They love
taking
characters.
There's so many characters.
They love reducing the amount of characters. I mean, that's the thing. You think it's bad?
That's what I'm
saying.
It
could easily be worse.
Don't have Cold Hands. Don't have Kevin in any capacity.
His hands are just lukewarm,
fair. Now we got Gold Hands, too, which is dangerous.
So Shay's surprise testimony does occur in the books, but it's for a different reason. In the books, she's very much more mercenary and like, okay, well, Tyrion can't give anything.
She's a gold-digging whore.
She's gold-digging whore, and this, it's just basically to screw over Tyrion for sending her away, which doesn't happen in the books.
Yep.
Trying to make Shay a more sympathetic character was admirable, and if it had been anyone but the actress, I think it would have worked. I just never really connected to that woman.
Okay.
So, fell flat for me. 407 Mockingbird, in the books, this Rorge character is the one that takes a bite out of, that's Biter, but the two guys that accost the Hound, they actually fought Brienne and Podrick. not Arya.
Hmm. Okay.
So I feel like this is another way to keep the Hound and Arya together, and it's a way to take Brienne out of this fight, and then now that you've got the Hound surviving, you can have them do the fight.
Hmm.
That's hard to argue that that's not a better choice.
But the way it turned out on screen, I'm super glad that happened.
I almost wonder if Martin could do it over again if he wouldn't do some of this stuff.
Maybe.
Because some of these changes, I think, are inarguably better.
Yeah, no, you wonder how much of a role he has in making these changes in the series.
I mean, he writes at least one episode a season, so...
Yeah. So where is... Like, what is the status of Arya at that point? If she's not, you know, stabbing people through the heart and learning so much about killing from the Hound, it doesn't seem like she's as fleshed out at this point in the book.
No, I mean... It's weird because they make her go, they make her get her first kills in very early on.
Oh, okay.
And it kind of happens pretty fast. Whereas this, the show, it's a much more gradual descent into her being a killer.
Yes.
So I feel like, again, it's hard to argue that that's not superior. And her chemistry with the Hound is just so good.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that they kept him alive. Oberyn told Tyrion the story of when he visited Castle Rock on the approach to King's Landing when they first met, not in the dungeons. Moving that to the dungeons and him saying, I'm the champion, I think...
Brilliant.
...is the way to go. That made that scene have some really serious oomph.
Absolutely.
It was badass in the books, but putting those scenes together just made it really, really resonant.
Mm-hmm.
In the books, there's this bard, Marillion... Who actually, Tyrion, you remember in season one, Joffrey had his tongue ripped out because he was making songs, making fun of his father being killed by a boar.
Okay.
That's the same guy. He actually is a character throughout the books, and he follows Sansa and Littlefinger to the Eyrie,
mm-hmm.
and he becomes like a court favorite of Lysa, and he's in the room when Peter chucks her out the moon door. And Peter actually blames him, the murder. He can't
say anything about it to defend himself, right?
Right. Well, no, he doesn't get maimed in the books.
Oh, okay.
But in the books, he has a patsy, and he doesn't rely on Sansa to lie for him to get his way.
Yeah, that felt a little awkward in the show.
A little awkward, and it made it feel like this was a roll of the dice, a crime of passion that Littlefinger, he didn't have an answer for. But it's hard to argue that it gave Sansa interesting things to do, and it really transformed her character. And you don't have endless monologues of Sansa in the books, and you have to have something like exclamation point. It's a little... It's on the border
of me. It's a little disappointing on Littlefinger's side.
Yes.
But I like it on Sansa's side, because what if without that moment... What is she left with as a character in the first four seasons of the show?
Well, we have some feedback on that to take you to task on that statement.
Okay.
But no, I mean, again, hard to argue that it does. It diminishes Littlefinger's Lex Lutherian, Batman-esque plotting a little bit. But it makes Sansa a much more interesting character sooner. Or conventionally interesting character, I should say. Anyway... And again, when Littlefinger chucks her out the door, he says, only cat rather than your sister. A thousand bricks were shat on.
Who gives a shit?
/r/ A Song of Ice and Fire.
/r/ who gives a shit?
We'll move on. Mountain and Viper. Ygritte never meets Gilly in the books as she hadn't returned to Castle Black yet. So basically everything of her and Moletown, her being spared. I don't have a problem with that.
Nah, that's fine.
A little irony, dramatic irony injected into the mix. We talked about the Marillion character and how he was made to confess to the crime, and that completely got Peter off the hook. And it's Littlefinger that does all the lying to the lords. It's not Sansa. Sansa doesn't reveal her identity to any of these people. That's an interesting change that might shake out a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Grey Worm and Miss Sandy, all that stuff's made up. That's a minor detail. In the books, there's a lot of rainbow imagery. Like, for example, Renly, his Kingsguard is the Rainbow Guard, which is kind of funny because he's a flamboyantly gay character.
Uh-huh.
But in this scene where Reek is going to Moat Cailin to treat with him, he's carrying a white flag. In the books, it's a rainbow flag.
Huh.
Because it's a representation of the faith of the seven. Got the seven
colors,
the Roy G. Biv,
the seven kingdoms,
seven aspects of the god. So the flag of truce is a rainbow truce, and it's a sign of peace as well.
Okay,
but you can imagine how ridiculous it would look for Theon to ride forth of the rainbow flag.
The internet would go crazy.
Yes, right. Yeah. There'd be so many image macros of Renly being or Loras being like, "Her."
They've already got the Game of Thrones videos. Oh, I mean, imagine how much worse they would be.
Yes. So Ramsay was legitimized much early in the books after the Red Wedding as a kickback to Roos. In the television show, it's a quid pro quo deal where Roos is like, "You take Moat Cailin, and I'll legitimize you." I feel like that was a way better change because
surprised him with it.
It makes their relationship kind of like. You get the feeling that Ramsay is a little bit of Roose's reek. He kind of verbally abuses him and puts him down and fosters this sense of inferiority and then rewards him occasionally with these things. And
you thought that's what he was doing when he asked his last name, right?
Yes.
Like, what is your last name?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a Snow. I'm not technically. Nope. You're a Bolton now.
Yeah. So I like that change. In the book, Ser Barristan reveals Jorah's secret a lot easier. The fact that he was not because he gets a letter from Tywin, but because he was actually present in the small council chambers in his capacity as Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. So he is a firsthand the spy reports.
Huh.
And in fact, when Danny,
how early does that happen?
Thing because it's this thing like you're both lying to me because he. And we talked about this last season. I know you weren't part of it. But he appears as this other character, Arison Whitebeard.
Uh-huh.
This guy with a long beard and like flowing monk robes. And he's kind of he does save Danny from the little manticore venom thing.
Okay.
The scorpion. But he doesn't say that I'm Barristan the Bold because obviously that's a kind of an issue. The fact that he was the Kingsguard to her, the usurper, right?
Sure. He might seem like the spy.
So... he eventually outs himself after he's been to Dany for a long time and earned her trust. And that kind of like has Dany's like, what the fuck? You know, I don't know who to trust. You're the blah, blah, blah. Huh. And then he throws the Jorah under the bus to kind of deflect. So she has this thing where she doesn't, you know, it's kind of like both of my advisors I can't trust. She ends up, you know, believing Barristan and kicking Jorah out. I don't know. I mean, to me, that felt kind of hokey in the books. And having
maybe
you not having, and you also can't pull off a disguise. Like if Barristan the Bold shows up in a hokey stage beard, us as viewers are going to be like, "Get the fuck out of here!"
Barristan.
That's Barristan, man. He can cut you down like all so much butter. That never
interesting.
Works.
So that kind of so it's weird in the show. He doesn't know, right? He's been exiled before that. He has to get the letter from Tywin to understand that Jorah was a spy.
Well, there was a lot of speculation because when he's introduced to Jorah,
they have
he's
a rough
got,
relationship already.
He's got kind of a knowing glance of people like, I wonder if he's keeping this to later on. But it turns out, no, this is the first he heard of it. And I kind of like how it played out. It's more like, nope, Jorah, you're the asshole. You're the one she can't trust. There's not as needless ambiguity there.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for her not to trust Barristan since he came to her as that and kind of begged forgiveness from the beginning. So this is kind of the only way they could have done it. And I feel like it's at least a neutral change, maybe even better.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else. Arya and Hound never go to the Vale, never go to the Bloody Gate.
Okay.
Well, actually, I don't think they just make it that far. They tried, but he got killed back in the... at the inn.
Killed or maybe
not
killed.
Not killed, maimed, whatever. Weakened, infected. Jaime and Tyrion, they never talked about their cousin, Orson, the thunker with the bugs. That's completely made up in the books, or made up for the series. I like the scene, though.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about, you know, what that meant. And I don't think we ever came up with a firm answer on that. But it did a lot of speculation, and I felt like it, you know, it built a connection between Jaime and Tyrion that maybe we hadn't completely firmed up yet,
right?
In our minds, I don't know. I liked it, though, a lot.
They also, the reason that Peter and Robin and Sansa leave the Eyrie, in the show, they make it seem like it's, hey, it's time for him to go out and see the Vale.
Yeah.
In the books, it's winter is also coming, and this is a high mountain castle. We got to get the fuck out of here, or we're going to be...
Huh.
So
people give a shit about winter in the book.
Yeah, the Eyrie...
Because nobody does right now.
In the Eyrie, yeah, it's like you cannot winter there. You have to go down out of the mountains, or you will die.
Huh.
So
wow.
That's just a subtle detail that's missed in the show. 409, Watchers on the Wall. The Wildlings... The battle north and south of the wall doesn't happen simultaneously.
Hmm.
The south forces attack, they're beaten back, and then Mance launches the attack from the north afterwards. But there's, you know, kind of a lull in the battle.
It seems like a much better idea to attack at the same time. To coordinate that attack and confuse them and overrun them.
Certainly, Pip and Grin both survive, and the only reason there's been interviews with the Double Ds, and they said, hey, you know, in the books, you had Donald Noyle, who was the blacksmith. It was, like, cool that you have a last stand and you cared about him. Nobody knows anybody but John, Pip, and Grin, so we killed Pip and Grin. And Sam.
Okay.
We killed Pip and Grin to try to wring some emotion out of the audience. Did it work, Jim?
No. Didn't give a shit.
I feel like there's a couple people that said they did feel something or were at least shocked and surprised. But if you weren't a book reader, I don't know why you would.
They were given so little screen time and no emotional impact.
Neither Sir Alistair or Jonas Slint were present at the wall at the beginning of the battle. They arrive in between the two battles.
Okay.
Ghost is still not reunited with Jon at this point in the books. Hmm. He's still off in the north fucking around. Tormund is with Mance during the battle. He's not one of the ones that climbed the wall with Ygritte and Jon, so thus he is not captured.
Okay.
Don't really care. In the books, it's never revealed who killed Ygritte. She's hit by an arrow fired from the castle. John,
really? It's completely just random.
Well, John, they're doing volleys of arrows, and he sees her go down an arrow, but he's like, did I kill her? Did someone else kill her?
Oh, Jesus.
She's still alive when he finds her after the battle, and she dies in his arm, pretty much like...
Say you know nothing, Jon Snow.
And he notices that his fletching, it's not the arrow that's actually in her, it's not one of his fletchings, so he knows it's not him. But yeah, they have
you have no idea who killed her. She just dies.
No, just dies of. But I like that. It's like, you know, they didn't have the whole kid from the village and his whole backstory. I like the fact that it's war. You die.
That's such a germ thing to do.
Mm,
like, let's indeed. Not even tell you who killed this main character who you have affection for.
Right. It's just war.
Just a random arrow.
I was disappointed in this. In the books, there's this wooden staircase switchback that's like the longer way to get up the wall rather than the winch. It's like the backup way.
Okay.
And in the books, they winch up the cage at the top, and the wildlings get through the castle. They start storming up the wall, and then the Black Brothers set the bottom of it on fire. They retreat to the top, set the bottom.
It's a Home Alone move. We've seen this 100 times. It's the gasoline-soaked rope.
It's exactly.
Yeah.
That's the climax and how they beat him is they cut it at the top and they burn it at the bottom and it kills almost the entire party.
Wow.
That didn't get killed by the withering barrage of arrows and stuff. So, that would have been cool to visualize though.
Yeah, definitely.
But they didn't.
Especially if you could take a wide shot of that with the flame burning up the side of this ice wall.
Yeah.
That'd be super cool.
But didn't happen. Let's see what else. There's different numbers in the battle. In the books, they make it seem like the wildlings have like 20 to 30,000 warriors, and there's more like 400 or 500 people in Castle Black because they pulled in brothers from the other castles, and they've also got a bunch of guys from Molestown.
Yeah,
so it's more of a fair fight, but it's like 50-1 instead of 1,000-1.
Sure.
It really doesn't matter. In the books, the wildlings, as I talked about in this episode, they use siege turtles and things to protect them while they're sapping the gates and the walls. But they still get crushed by the ice filled barrels and the flaming barrels. So I don't know. I think it would be neat to at least show that they thought about maybe the protection. Yeah. there's no giant scythe and no wildlings try to climb the wall because it's stupid.
Yep.
Although cool looking.
Cool looking.
And in the battle, the books, the John doesn't go out to meet Mance of his own free will. He's actually ordered to by Sir Alistair, to go bastard. Out there and take Longclaw and betray him. Final season finale, 410 The Children, and then we'll get to some feedback. When John met with Mance, he had, I already talked about this, he had his Longclaw and was prepared to use it when Stannis attacked. In the books, Mance doesn't easily surrender. He's captured by force. I thought it's more noble to have Mance, like, genuinely care about his people.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah. His goal was a little muddy to me the entire time. So, like, and I know now, you know, he's just looking to get south of the wall, preserve his people. So it kind of lines up more with his goals. He just wants to get south of the wall, let us go. We really want a war. We just want to live. I like it.
I think he's the one that sent it. He'll be pleased to note that in the books, the battle outside is a little bit longer, that there are giants and mammoths that hold off the initial cavalry charges, but they're later encircled and destroyed. So, you know, it'd be cool to see. It would be cool to see mounted knights charging against mammoths and giants.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they shot their wad in the previous episode. What are you going to do? Cersei never sees Sir Gregor being treated in the books, but it's relayed information. And Gregor is not... They make it a point in the books that, for some reason, Gregor is in constant pain, maybe because of complications from him growing so fast or being so huge. But he drinks milk of the poppy like most men drink beer.
Huh.
And it's a point that the maesters are like, we can't knock this guy out. We're giving him enough to kill a man, and he's still screaming. And there's this plot point to where you can just hear his screams all through the Red Keep, and Cersei has him moved down to the dungeons so he doesn't bother anyone.
Get him out of here.
Yeah, because Cersei's a nice person. Brienne and Hound never meet in the books. Instead, she meets an outlaw who's picked up the Hound's helmet after he quote-unquote dies.
And it's way too big for him. It's just bobbling around on his head.
Like a big bobblehead, and she duels him instead.
I can't see anything. It's spun around.
Cersei never spills the beans to Tywin about their incestuous relationship. Neither does she threaten to go public with that information.
Huh. That was a pretty big deal in this season.
And it's one of those changes where it seems momentous until you realize that Tywin's dead at the end.
Sure.
It doesn't really matter.
Absolutely.
But I kind of did like Tywin being defied successfully by one of his children.
By all of his children
by
at
all
the
of
end.
His children,
I mean, one of them kills him. The other releases the guy who kills him.
Yeah, it's so irony that his legacy and his family was the thing that's important. And that's the thing that led literally to his downfall.
Sweet. Very sweet.
Jojen doesn't die in the books.
Who gives a shit?
Not me, not you. In the books, so this is a little spoilery too, but I don't know. You tell me. We could edit it out if we have to. In the books, the Three-Eyed Crow is badass.
Okay.
He's this withered, hundreds-year-old dude where tree roots growing through him. He's got a tree root growing out of his eye. He's barely alive. Like, do you know anything about Warhammer 40K canon?
The bare minimum.
Like, the Emperor of Man is thousands of years old, and he's kept alive on this golden throne. He's this desiccated corpse.
And he uses the souls of the people he kills or whatever to supply.
He's a lot like that, only instead of this golden throne, it's the trees. And it's just so fucking rad.
Mm-hmm.
Me and the other book readers are like, this guy? We got Pei Mei from Kill Bill? That's the one thing I found outrageous. Like, that's just, you bring in Greg Nicotero for an afternoon and you're done.
Yep.
You're done.
I feel like that's a missed opportunity.
Or leave him in shadows, because it's not like we got to get, and then next year go Gonzo with his makeup. I can't believe they didn't make him that cool.
That's kind of shitty. Yeah.
Super shitty. Anyway, again, I feel like there's no way they can bring him back next year and have him looking that way, right?
No, they've got to keep him roughly the same. Although, who knows? They recast the mountain three times, so...
That's true. Yeah. So, it might be a spoiler because they might do him up right next year.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just saying that I was pretty pissed about the lack of fidelity to his appearance.
Maybe they're going to take him mobile.
Plus, it's like...
Maybe he's going to be out in a backpack on Hodor's back like Yoda.
It doesn't make any sense when he says, I've been watching you, Bran, with 1,000 eyes and one. You have two fucking eyes, old man.
Yep.
It makes sense when you got a freaky deaky vine growing out one eye socket. With 1,000 eyes and 2, 4 if you count my glasses. Oh, Jesus. Anyway, in the books, we've already talked about this. In the books, Jaime and Tyrion really only meet for the first time when he's freeing Tyrion.
Oh, okay.
And there's a lot more to it that I'm not going to get into. In fact, I'm not going to get into any of the difference between the books because that might actually be a minor spoiler for next season.
All right.
In the books, Tyrion kills Tywin with a single crossbolt to the pelvis, which causes his bowels to loosen. South Park
style. Just
helping
him out.
Which then Tyrion Riley observes that Tywin Lannister did not, in fact, shit gold.
Jesus.
Seriously, that's the book went with a poop joke for the death of Tywin.
Nice.
You like that? Do you like the poop joke? Did they need the poop joke?
They didn't need the poop joke. I think it worked perfectly fine as is. Yeah, no poop joke necessary.
The whereabouts of Varys are unknown in the book.
Oh shit.
After his treachery at King's Landing.
Okay. I'm curious what he does after this.
Me too.
Does he get on that boat? Go with Tyrion? Does he stay around?
He gets on the
King's
boat.
Landing?
Does he stay in the boat? Does he pull a Shay? Does he wind up in Tywin's quarters? Where is this going to go?
Huh.
In the books, the chaining process was a lot more difficult. She had to, like, the one was easy enough, but then the second, when she goes to lead him down to the catacombs, he can hear his brother screaming, and he's like, fuck this shit, and it ends up killing, like, six Unsullied to try to net him up and down there. And Drogon's sleeping in the Great Pyramid, and he sees all this, and they actually go to try to take him, and
he just bounces.
He kills a bunch of them and takes off. So it feels, because you had problems like Dany's completely lost control over dragons.
Yeah.
In the books, it's more like she's aware that they're out hunting in the countryside. She doesn't think much of it until a dead child comes up, and then she tries to retroactively put the genie in the bottle, and the dragons are like, fuck this shit.
If they had just
showed much more betrayal, I guess.
If they had just showed Drogon sleeping in his lair, like once throughout the season, I would have understood, okay, they're kind of close by, you know, and they go out and they do their thing, kill some goats.
It wasn't like, it's 10 o'clock, Danny. Do you know where your dragons are? It wasn't like a public service announcement, yeah.
But in the series, it just seems like they're who knows where.
Yeah. No, so that's a little bit less effective, I think.
Yeah.
That's the big differences.
Okay.
We got some feedback, and then I've got some spoiler stuff to talk about, which we'll dismiss you for, but we've got quite a bit of feedback.
Bring it on.
As well. Before we get to feedback, we gotta pay the bills, right, Jim?
Yeah.
And I very much appreciate everyone responding to our calls for iTunes support, for Amazon support, for Subbable. I'm going to make one last attempt for our Game of Thrones audience. You know, Jim and I do this. If you enjoyed our expanded coverage, if you've enjoyed our spoiler takes, the only reason we're able to do these is because we've made the choice in 2014 to make a leap of faith to do this as a full-time basis. And the reason we've been able to do that is not just because of the support of the fine folks at Hover, but also, mostly, the vast majority is direct listener support.
Mm-hmm.
The way to do that this year is subbable.com/baldmove. It's a voluntary subscription site. You can sign up and pledge us money. And I'll tell you what, I know no one's ever going to do this, because if everyone gave $1 per month, we would be smoking $100 cigars and on a yacht, and we'd probably make off with a big bag of money after one season, and you destroy the whole thing.
Sure.
So it's probably not a good idea for everyone to give $1 per month, mm-hmm. but I just want you guys to know that Sally Struthers-esque, for less than a cup of coffee, you could keep these two podcasters in gin and scotch and whiskey and making podcasts for a long time to come. And don't think that that's like, oh, that's a bullshit amount, because it would be huge if people mm-hmm. did that. And the cool thing is, not only do you get our podcasts by supporting us, and also, spoiler alert, you get it even if you don't, but what you do get is you can bank up every dollar that you save, every fiver that you send us. You can bank that up for exclusive Bald Move memorabilia and merchandise. You can get custom shout-outs. You can do podcast dedications. You know, your favorite episode of Breaking Bad, you can shout out your sweetie. It'll be there forever in our archive on that long tail. We get 3,000 to 5,000 people listening to our back catalogs every fucking day. Can you fucking believe it?
Yeah.
So there's a long tail there and lots of value. You can custom commission podcasts. Go to subbable.com/baldmove to find out all the things you can do and all the rewards that you get for your investment in us personally. And thank you, thank you, thank you for the individuals that have done that. Also, if you don't want to directly contribute us, if you're using Amazon, amazon.baldmove.com, you type that before you go to Amazon, everything in your cart that you purchase on that session, we get a tiny cut of. And it adds up when thousands and thousands of fans do it to something special, and we appreciate everybody. People say, Aaron, how do we do that on our smartphones? There's a trick where you can use the Amazon the app, which you can't use affiliate links for. You just use the Amazon.com app. You put everything in your cart. Then you go to your mobile phone browser, go to amazon.baldmove.com. Boom, your cart's there. You just have to do the one-click checkout, so you get the best of both worlds. You can support us and still use the app. Just a little tip for those of you that wanted to do that. And if you can't do any of that stuff, please rate and review us on iTunes. It's how we collect more listeners. It's how we stay relevant in the What's Hot list, which we've been dominating this season. It's no accident that we've grown so much. And that's all due to your guys's and your sharing our stuff on Facebook and Twitter and telling our friends and coworkers or family about us. Please continue to do that. Send the Bald Move. We'll know what to do with them. Also, it doesn't have to end here, y'all. We've got full coverage of Fargo, which is awesome. We've got coverage of 24, the Jack Bauer Power Hour. It's insane. It's a little bit more lighthearted than our standard take. We've got a ridiculous True Blood podcast I'm doing with my girlfriend that's coming out this week. I got an Orange is the New blog, Orange is the New podcast, rather. Orange is the New Black podcast that I've got a rotating list of all-star female podcasters helping me out on. We've got a TV podcast. We're talking about Halt and Catch Fire and a bunch of new summer stuff like The Strain.
Falling Skies just dropped.
Skies started there. We've got so much content on baldmove.com to choke a donkey. Don't think that this is it until next year. It's only that if you got no interest in any good television, period. Because we're covering a shitload of it. Go to baldmove.com and see if there's anything that tickles your fancy or floats your boat. And that's it. I think had a little expanded pimping section for a little expanded podcast. Let's get into feedback.
Sounds good.
Chris K said, I think Arya did have a little love for the Hound. On the whole, this season has pushed the notion of Arya becoming a cold, distant, and quite frankly, deadly killer. She has no problem killing. They've displayed this in the show even more than in the books at this stage in the story. I think she couldn't do it, though. She knew if she left him that his blood wouldn't be on her hands. She promised herself every night for over a year that she would kill Sandor, the Hound. Yet when given the chance, even while he begged for her, she couldn't bring herself to kill him. In the books, I always thought that's why she didn't finish him, and the show has given me more reason to hold on to my belief that while this poor little girl that we've been following since childhood isn't yet completely void of feelings or conscious. Chris is basically saying she's splitting the difference between her code of justice, which demands she kill her, versus her affection for the Hound. So leaving him to die on his own is kind of like the middle ground.
Sure, I could buy that.
I like that take.
Yeah.
It's kind of an Obi-Wan Kenobi shitty move because it's like, I'm leaving you to die in agony, Anakin, a legless freak slowly burning out of lava. But don't forget, you're the asshole. But on the other hand, he's not shedding the blood of his friend. So
yeah.
Whatever. I like that. Annel said, uh-oh, you're about to get taken to task for your Sansa hate.
Like I'm worried.
Annel says, I am disappointed in your low opinion of Sansa. She lumps me in this too.
Oh, you deserve it because I get lumped into your shit all the time.
What shit?
God, I can't believe you guys hated this episode so much. I didn't. It was Aaron.
No, bullshit. Are you talking about a game? Are you talking about Watching Dead?
That's certainly,
oh yeah, I do get you in trouble on Breaking Bad too.
You get me in trouble on a lot of shows.
All right, fine. We're even.
We're even now. Yeah.
She's disappointed in your low opinion of Sansa Stark. You both seem to be on the side of taking an objective view of a character and on the side of feminism, but I continually hear that up until the end of season 4, especially Jim found her boring and quote-unquote not a real character. For me, Sansa is one of the most compelling, realistic portrayals of a female character in a hugely patriarchal society. While it may be more fun to root for Brienne, Arya, Asha slash Yara, Ygritte, or Dany, they are all functioning more or less as men in this Westerosi man's world. Sansa is one of the few female characters we see who enjoys being feminine, and it pains me to see her being written off as uninteresting simply because she isn't rampaging around leaving Death in her wake.
I take issue. Okay.
What? Jim has complained that Sansa hasn't really quote-unquote done anything, but have you forgotten the rules of the game of what, the Thrones? You win or you die, and Sansa has not died yet. Remember, she is raised to be a noble lady.
Because she hasn't played.
She's raised to be a noble lady, and as the oldest daughter in one of the most important noble houses, she was in training as much as any squire, and she excelled in it. On first meeting, she even impressed Cersei and managed to convince the conniving queen that she would be a good match for her perfect son and heir to the throne. She was a child when she was brought to King's Landing, and while she did betray her father, she was trying to do the right thing. When she realized her mistake, she did everything she could to win mercy for her father, but her betrothed shocked everyone with his vicious stupidity by beheading the House of Stark anyway. Mm-hmm. And where did that leave Sansa? She was left completely alone in a nest of enemies, engaged to a sadistic psychopath who had irrationally beheaded her father right in front of her. Mm-hmm. What was she supposed to quote-unquote do? It's always much too easy to blame the victim of an abusive relationship for her situation and forget the extreme power imbalance and within which she is caught. She's under a constant...
Whoa, I'm not blaming her for anything.
She's under constant threat of sexual assault to the point where she had a panic attack when her moon's blood arrived, not mm-hmm. only from Joffrey, but from the Hound as well. Considering all the opportunities for rape, grievous injury, or death that were serious daily realities for Sansa, I see her uninjured survival as borderline miraculous. Even when she finally finds quote-unquote safety in the view, her last known living relative tries to throw her to her death because she was the victim of Littlefinger's unwanted sexual assault. Now she's become Littlefinger's captive and protege, as Westeros is no longer capable of supporting any woman who's not a deadly threat. When the dust settles one day and peace inevitably returns, where will the ladies be? The good and kind wives and mothers. Sansa's arc is one of the most tragic because it signifies the loss of the kind of world that people like Ned and Oberyn and even Cersei would want their daughters to grow up in. What parent has a daughter that hopes that she will grow up to be like a sociopath assassin like Arya or a conniving sexual manipulator like Margaery, even if we as readers like them as characters? Boom. Drops the mic. Jim, your response.
Okay. So let me first say I agree with a lot of what she says there. Part of the hazard of doing a 2.5 hour podcast every single week on a show is that you have to find different language to describe the same things kind of over and over again.
Yes.
So maybe I misspoke when I said that she isn't a real character. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that she, you know, she's a compelling character for all the reasons she mentions. Just being a woman in this situation, it's a very difficult thing to do. She's put in a horrible situation.
And survives,
miraculously, like she said. What I mean is she's not doing anything toward getting out of this situation. I realize she's pinned down, right? Certainly there are way more powerful people working against her here.
Right.
And if she tries to make a move, she may die. Like you said, you play the Game of Thrones or you die. Mm. She's not playing the game. Whereas you take a woman like Margaery, mm-hmm. who I feel is playing the exact role of a woman in this universe, mm-hmm. like she's saying that Sansa should and is, but she's doing things. She's actively working on this Game of Thrones.
Right.
So I feel like the character of Sansa is just not doing as much toward a goal that the viewers care about as like a Margaery or Olenna or people like that.
I do think Anne's point where that's kind of fucked up that Arya, who's the murderous psycho, and Margaery, who's this sexual manipulator, are the ones we're like, yeah, they're interesting to watch.
Yeah.
But it's the same argument like Walter White. If he was just a meek science teacher that accepted his death with the shitty American medical insurance industry.
6 months and I'm out.
Yeah, it wouldn't be interesting. And that would actually be a different type of story. It'd be the tragedy of, politics and healthcare and insurance and money in America. It wouldn't be the badass dead man trying to amass a fortune for his family, getting caught up in it. Yeah. So yeah, it's like.
But it's a little more forgivable in this scenario where there are 1,000 characters already doing that, I guess.
Certainly.
So she doesn't necessarily need to be a Margaery,
right?
Or an Olenna, maybe. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the emailer's name here.
Anne.
Maybe Anne is right. I need to cut her a little more slack. I just feel like she did some stuff in season one. Then she kind of just took a break because of her situation. And now we're getting back to where she's freed up again, and she can actually turn into a character who takes action.
Yeah, and then I just feel like that's... I think Anne's point is well taken, and it's interesting in a sociological standpoint. But on the other hand, just like we as viewers find... Theon grating when he's just abused and abused and abused with outlet. It's like, my God. Sansa's kind of like a slightly lower intensity Theon fuckover that lasts three seasons.
Lasts three times long, yeah.
And so it's like, I don't feel like you can feel bad for saying that that is hard to watch or not as interesting as the other stuff. It's to the extent that that's fucked up about our pop culture, it is fucked up about our pop culture.
So, yeah, but
it's also not, I also don't think you should feel bad for falling into that quote unquote trap.
Sure, and I don't want to take total credit away from the character of Sansa or the actress who plays her. I think she did a hell of a job, even in like seasons one and two, where she was actively fighting for her father. She was trying to resist Joffrey as much as she could.
Yeah.
But then once she gets pinned down, it's just like, ugh, I've seen episode after episode after episode of her being walked all over.
Right.
Is that really what I want to see for another whole season?
Devin from Maine said, while reading the books and watching the show, I always suspected Shay was an agent for Tywin. This would explain why she never took the threats at court seriously and why she was always trying to get more information out of Tyrion. For me, this theory was reinforced by Littlefinger's monologue from season one, where he explains to Ned that every set of eyes and ears at court are feeding information to one or the other of the major players. When one considers the facts that Tywin was an expert political operator and never gave Tyrion any power before naming him substitute hand, it makes sense that Tywin would find a way to monitor Tyrion while at court using his weakness for women. This has some darker implications that maybe Tywin also turned Bronn at an earlier point.
This is super interesting because I feel like there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to say that Tywin may have had a hand in Joffrey's death and framing Tyrion. Unfortunately, they just lay it out that Littlefinger did it.
Yeah.
And you said that it was much more of a mystery, right, throughout the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, you eventually, to the extent that where when Littlefinger first laid it out, I'm like, nah, he's bragging. No, no fucking way. Like, my blew my mind such that I immediately said that this is just Littlefinger shining on the
Sansa.
I since now feel like that's no straight up legit. That arguably, everything that's happened has been the work of Littlefinger creating his chaos ladder that he can climb.
Yeah,
which is fucked up. But yeah, so
there's some circumstantial stuff with Tywin, because I mean he hates Tyrion.
Yeah. Doesn't trust Tyrion.
Setting up Oberyn to kind of take a fall later on felt a little Tywin-y. I don't know.
And maybe Tywin somewhere in the pit of his belly was worried that Tyrion would be such a good hand and so beloved of the small folks that he would have a hard time displacing him.
Maybe.
So he's like, I'll send this whore with him to be like this self-destruct device. I told him not to bring a whore to court. This will cause him to behave irrationally, and this will be his undoing. I don't know I buy all that, but I don't have any direct...
I think if you buy what Littlefinger says, you can't buy any of that.
Sure. So, Rodney says, compared to previous seasons, the beginning of this season, King's Landing is really lacking compelling characters. We've lost Tywin, Varys, Olenna, Oberyn, Joffrey, Littlefinger, and of course Tyrion. Some not obviously to death, but they're just not a player at King's Landing.
Yeah.
I don't think, honestly, that Cersei and Margaery will be able to carry the drama. Jim, is he right to be concerned that King's Landing is going to be a dull, dull place next year?
With an undead mountain walking around? Fuck that. It's going to be more action-packed than ever.
All right. Mildly interesting.
I'm hedging my bets on that undead mountain. I'm not sure that's what's going to happen, but it'd be nice.
Friend of the show, Willis, says this is a little bit of a step back. Wait a second. There's
take
a super
step back.
Sorry, I poor edit here. There's a super interesting dynamic revealed with Mance and Jon's bromance. You mentioned there was some level of difficulty with some regarding killing Mance, bringing an end to the Wildling Alliance, and also mentioned that it's odd there was so much exposition about the heritage of the Giants. My take on that is that this is what gives us direct insight on the why killing Mance would break down the group. What makes him different from the other quote-unquote leaders north of the walls is background in the South, what seems to have given him the insight needed to unite these tribes. History and legacy are things that resonate deeply with humans and humanoids. But if the tribes of the North were so haphazard about that knowledge as it seems, perhaps out of a need for survival, then the deep knowledge he seems to have of the legacy of each tribe could be a powerful leverage in making these groups click as a single force. Add that to the White Walker threat, and you've a recipe for creating a unified front through respect and mutual enemy. I feel like there's subtlety here, and maybe I'm full of shit, but the difference between Mance's demeanor and that of the Wildlings at large seems like the linchpin in his ability to lead them all as a group. He seems very genuine as a protector of life, which is hard to find in almost any character we've met. He further shows his respect for all that as he toasts both his warrior and his enemy that fell fighting each other. That's yet another sign of his deep respect for life and a difference from his wild buddies as he honors its loss on both sides of the battlefield. Let's take that first point. What do you think of there? That Mance takes the Southron respect for heritage and titles north to forge an alliance amongst these wildling tribes.
Oh boy. I think this, I don't know anything about the history is the trouble. I mean, I know he kind of lays it out, so I'll take his word for all that.
Neither is Will. He's not a book reader, so don't be shy. This is just speculation.
If that's the case, they certainly don't even imply any of that in the show, right?
What do you mean? No, this is all subtext.
There's no reason other than getting his people south of the wall, and I need a big fucking army to do that. For him to unite these clans,
right?
In the show, now I think it's a nice addition to his character if he is kind of noble and respects life and respects kind of lineage and history a little bit more than the other peoples, and that gives him some kind of insight into how to lead them. Certainly, I think that makes a lot of sense. But I it's not shown to me, so who knows?
Sure. That's it for the feedback we have. We've got some spoiler stuff that it's, you know, some more overt spoilers and some stuff about the tinfoil segment that I've had running. But you're not privy to that. It's not for you, Jim, or for any of the other non-book readers. We'll consider it after our wall of music. Just want to tell everybody, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
It's been an incredible season. The amount of traffic we're getting on this podcast is fucking incredible. Like, we were expecting to double our stats from last season. Mm. We've almost tripled our stats. And the week-over-week growth has been just staggering. And it's because you people are telling others about us. It's because you're rating and review us on iTunes. It's because, I mean, you know, I'm an active Redditor. I don't actually post much, but I read almost everything. And it always warms my heart to see whenever a thread is asked about what, you know, podcasts you enjoy. We always get mentioned. All that kind of stuff helps us grow the community, helps support Jim and I, and can't thank you enough for listening and for everything you guys do, all the feedback you send us.
That's honestly, that's super important, because when I started this season, I didn't know hardly anything. And I think it showed about the world, about the characters. I was just following it as a viewer, just having fun with the series.
Sure.
And it's given me a much deeper appreciation for the series as a whole, the characters in it, the world that's being built, that our listeners write in and tell us about. And
sure.
And writers like Anne who write in and call me on my bullshit and kind of set me straight on some of the stuff, I think that helps a lot. You know, I don't want everybody to jump on that bandwagon and start fricasseeing me, but yeah, I appreciate all the feedback that comes in, because it helps me understand this series a lot more. It's a huge world.
That's what people don't know, is how hard it is to the feedback. As you can imagine, I had way more feedback than I could use last year.
Oh, hell
yeah. On a cast by cast basis, and now we got 3 times the traffic, 3 times the feedback.
Yeah.
It really sometimes hurts that I have to cut. Like, Anne had twice as much stuff and a lot more supporting argument, but I just couldn't afford to read it all. Same thing, Will. He had a couple other good points. Yeah. Lots of people same way. I have to take bits and pieces, and some, you know, when you're the 10th person that said a really awesome thing.
You got to get cut. Sorry.
You get cut because someone beat you to it by maybe an hour or two. And, you know, that's the one bad thing about getting big is that you lose the ability to respond to everything and even read everything. But I do appreciate hearing from everyone and seeing everybody's unique flavor, and it definitely makes it a stronger cast. And I think that's about all I want to say about that.
Okay.
But truly, we're grateful for the community and the support you've given us.
Absolutely.
That's it. We're going to sign off for the last time until next spring. Again, if you're an adventuresome show watcher or your book reader, you're welcome to stay behind the wall of music to get into our spoiler section. But until next spring, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim. See you
winter, then. Winter will come and then leave, and it'll be spring, and we'll have a new season. Awkward transition out. Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, the Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm found. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar to Harris, all men must serve. See, as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar, my rulers, all men must die. All right, everybody, we're safe in the spoiler section. Everything I said before about my gratefulness to an audience goes double for you people that have been listening to me trying to carry a podcast by myself with no co-host. It is extremely challenging, and I appreciate so much all the positive feedback and how much people have enjoyed the tinfoil section. That's been a lot of work. I put a lot of time into researching that and getting my notes and having it down enough that I can explain it in a logical manner. And it feels really good to hear people like get really jazzed about. It seems like the biggest hits were the Roose Bolton, the Bolton, the Roose's Loose theory, and also the High Septon equals Howland Reed theory. Very well received too. And it means a lot when you guys write in and say I did a good job and that you've enjoyed it, and it keeps me motivated. And I also don't have a lot of book reader friends personally, and it's a nice outlet to be able to talk and share enthusiasms and our fears and our hopes and dreams for the series and kind of piece together information. So I am proud of the book reader population that we cultivated here at Bald Move, and I've really enjoyed the segment. And without further bullshit, let's get this last one under our belts. Dan M has some casting news for us. They've already talked. I think these are open casting calls. This is not the actual actors who will be appearing. This is the ones that they're actually casting for. And you want us to talk about maybe what impact they'll have. They're casting Doran Martell, which is Oberyn's older brother. They mentioned he's kind of sickly. He has the gout. He hasn't left Doran for a while. Tristan Martell, which is his son. Aerio Hota, which is the captain of Doran's bodyguard, and he's kind of a badass POV character in the book. I like him a lot. They're specifically casting a black actor for the role, which I think is really cool. Obara, Nymeria, Tynea, Sand, these are the bastard daughters, a.k.a. the Sand Snakes. Apparently Obara will have a major fight with a character that she does not encounter in the books. That is very interesting. They're casting the High Sparrow and Septon Ulna, or Anella. Very interested to see how that plays out, if he's Howland Reedy looking, if he's a little Cranaganish. Very interested to see how far they get with Cersei's plot, whether they'll, you know, is this going to be a episode 9, her walk of shame kind of moment, which will leave us in a really nice position for the Winds of Winter stuff to begin in earnest the following season. Maggie the Frog in a one episode call-in, probably going to be a flashback to Cersei's, means we're probably going to get the Valonqar plot in place, which we had a tinfoil section on the possible meanings behind Valonqar. Lala Stokeworth, who's Bronn's wife in the books, and she's slightly more prominent. I mean, we've actually met her in the books, haven't so much on the show. Does that mean that we're going to get more of Bronn? Is it possible that Bronn continues his role as Illyn Payne replacement as Jaime goes forth to bring the Riverlands to the King's Peace? I think that would be cool. And it would be cool to see Lawless and to see a little bit of Bronn's relationship or lack thereof with her. Finally, Princess Marcella is going to be recast from the little girl that we saw weeping as she's boated away to Dorne. So probably going to get the Darkstar plot. Probably going to get the attempted throne crowning of her in Dorne. Really interesting stuff. And I feel that maybe the producers, from what I can tell, are gearing up more to end this about where Dance and Feast ended. Maybe a little bit more new material from the Winds of Winter, but nothing I see here is conclusively saying that they're going to start spoiling the books, even if it takes George R. R. Martin another year to get this stuff out. Let's see, what else we got? Dan Snow says, I love all the casts. Heard you mention about a possible prequel season. I was dismissive about the possibility of a prequel season, but we did mention it. He says, at first I thought it'd be pretty stupid, but on second thought they could use it just before the last season to have some pretty big reveals that would set up the final alliances and battles. Thinking about the possibilities for that. You could have the tourney of Harrenhal, trial by combat, slash death of Rickard and Brandon Stark, the great battle between Robert and Rhaegard at the Trigant, the murder of Elia Martell and her children, also featuring the smuggling of the real Aegon Targaryen by John Connington, quote-unquote around the real, please. They could even show secret pacts between the Martells and the Targaryens to eventually overthrow the Lannisters. We could see the origin of Littlefinger and the Tully girls and Brandon Stark, their relationship, Varys and Ilios rise to power in the slums of Braavos, Illyria, rather. The season could end with the revenge of the Sith-like secret transferring of babies to be heroes, Jon Snow, Daenerys, and Aegon Targaryen. Yeah, the thing, Dan, is that is all very interesting, and that would be very compelling from a series standpoint, and arguably could help usher in maybe some later reveals that are going to feature the books. I just cannot see HBO saying, we are going to shut this production down, and we're going to let Macy and Isaac and Sophie get another year older, and we're going to try to keep this whole band together while we go off and tell this other story. The only possible reason, because none of this stuff, I mean, there's not enough material. I mean, I know there's enough material, but there's no long digressions about all this stuff in the books to warrant a whole season. And the only reason they do that is to give George Martin a longer chance to write the concluding books. And I don't see HBO as that charitable an enterprise. I don't think they care about his legacy and allowing him to finish the books in his time. If they did, I don't think they'd be making as much, or the Double D's wouldn't be making as much of the fact that they've got the last little bit of details from George R. R. Martin that they'd need to tell the story. So at this point, I'm more worried about George just not dying and finishing it. I mean, that would be the really horrific thing. I think he's going to have the Winds of Winter. I'm one of the few naive fools that thinks he'll have the Winds of Winter out before this starts back up, or maybe concurrently with it starting back up next season, by the end of the season for sure, before the season 6 for definitely. But, you know, can he get a Dream of Spring out? He's now talking about a potential 8th book. I'm very nervous about how long it's taking him versus how much material. And what I think, the only thing I think would really bother me, it'd be one thing if the Double D's have a Cliff Notes version of the books that they then make a series off of and we later get the full story. It would really bother me if we have a Robert Jordan situation where Martin just dies with one book to complete and they have to bring in a ghost author or a shadow author or someone to come in and do the definitive take. I just don't, that would really bother me as a book reader and as even a show of the fan, or as a fan of the show, rather. Moving on to Joffrey said, they may try and get most of A Dance of Dragons in next season. I think that's a safe bet. I'm not a book reader, but I was spoiled on the Lady Stoneheart part. I don't expect to see her at the start of the season. As you said in last episode, I think that they're going to swing this into a Mother's Day thing. Ha! That will put us 4 or 5 episodes into the new season. What do you think? I think that's brilliant, Joffrey. I think that, I don't think it was intentional that Tywin was killed on Father's Day, but if they do have Lady Stoneheart appearing on Mother's Day, I'll start to give that theory a little bit more credence. That would be some awesome cross-promotional fuckery by the Double D's. And I got a couple of people saying that they don't think the Lady Stoneheart is going to be in, that they're afraid that the Double D's are going to flush it down the toilet. If you listen to my podcast last week, you already know that I don't believe this, but I just want to reiterate, I don't believe in any universe that Lady Stoneheart is not going to be featured prominently going forward. I mean, it'd be one thing if I had a copy of The Winds of Winter and I read that and she is a very minor character. If she's a minor character in The Winds of Winter and none of the more elaborate Grand Northern Conspiracy stuff involving the Riverlands comes to fruition, then maybe. But as it is, I think there's too much cool stuff. Where would Brienne's storyline be going? What's the impetus to have her back with Jaime? What is her and Jaime's story the rest of the series? Lady Stoneheart is the catalyst for all that. And it has to be something like that. And someone said, well, you know, it's disrespectful to the character of Catelyn. It's hokey. It's cliche. I don't buy any of that bullshit. Why foreshadow Beric Dondarrion's coming back from the dead with the Lord of Light's powers if not to use it with Lady Stoneheart? I don't think it's disrespectful to the character of Catelyn Stark. I think it's exactly the character Catelyn Stark would be if she came back to life after the Red Wedding and wanted revenge on all the Freys and Lannisters and Boltons that she could find. I think it's extreme. Like, people are like, oh, Lady Stoneheart, she's so vengeful. It's not bullshit. Cat Stark's got a mean streak a mile long. Look how she viewed Jon Snow. His only sin was that he was a bastard of Ed. You murder her firstborn and all of her children? In her mind, you know, I don't think that she is exceptionally brutal or cold by Cat Stark standards at all. Again, that's just my opinion. Nathan P. says, one thing that struck me after finishing the season was the lack of Yara Greyjoy in the entire season. At the end of season 3, one of the main things that people were looking forward to was Yara's fight for her brother and against the Boltons, but this only amounted to around 10 minutes of combat in the season. Considering that she'll be a crucial player in the Kingsmoot storyline, giving her own claim to the throne, it surprises me that showrunners don't give us more reasons to support her. Also, the best way to introduce new characters is to take people we already know and have grown to like, and then move them into the new group of people, i.e. Theon with his father, and Yara, Catelyn Stark with the Baratheons, Jon and the Wildlings, yet they miss this chance with Yara. The showrunners could have really had Yara prove herself this season as having a real claim as leader of the Ironborn Greyjoys, and gather a fan base or rallying point at the audience. Instead, after all the hype and the grand attitude from her mission last season, we were given 10 minutes of filler action, which ended her defeat and abandonment of her original quest. I agree that is some weak sauce. On the other hand, the Double D's were kind of in a bind, because the time is not right for her to swing back into action, and she has very little to do between, you know, leaving the North and the King's Moot. So you could argue that should have just left her and not have her do anything with Theon. I do feel like that speech she gave where she roused the Ironborn kind of gives her leadership bona fides. But no, it is a problem, and I'm curious to see how they do it. And I've been a longtime proponent of the theory that the King's Moot's just not going to happen. I'm really paying attention to the casting news to see. I feel like if we get one new Ironborn Islander casted, if we get a Victarion and that's it, then they probably won't do the Kingsmoot. And then I don't know what the hell they're going to do with Yara / Asha. If we see Euron and Victarion both, then I feel the Kingsmoot is a go, and we probably will have a traditional kind of role for her to play going forward. And they'll just have to hope that they can make her awesome and those scenes compelling enough that the show people will give a damn about it. We'll see. I'm coming around on the Kingsmoot thing, though. I feel like I had no idea they were going to pull so much dance and feast material into this season. And they've done so. You know, if I thought that next season was going to be all feast and the season after that was going to be all dance, or maybe they're going to do one combined season, feast, dance, it doesn't seem like you got room for the Kingsmoot. You pull in a good amount of feast and dance into this season, suddenly that you got room for the Kingsmoot. So we'll have to see how that goes. Sean from Kansas says, I love that the Howland Reed equals High Septon theory. I've always thought it strange that we haven't seen Howland Reed do much yet other than send his children to help Bran, of course, or even meet him. Having him operating King's Landing makes more sense than having him pop up at the neck or out of the neck in book 6 or 7 just to say, hey, everyone, R plus L equals J. To take the theory just a little further, what if the sparrows that came with him to King's Landing are 90% or more Crannog men? It's unclear how many men Howland Reed has at his command, but they were absent from the War of the Five Kings. What if he basically walked his army right into King's Landing and then tricked Cersei into letting him arm them as the poor fellows and the warrior's sons? That is an amazing theory, and I love everything about it. And it would not surprise... I've added it to my tinfoil headcanon that not only is a High Septon Howland Reed, but a good percentage of the sparrows are Crannogan men that he has bolstered with other poor, downtrodden faithful of the Seven. Now, I love that theory, and I appreciate you sending it in, and I am hyped about it. Thank you for that, Sean. Reed from Vancouver says, I did some Reed-related reading to further explore the theory, and I found some interesting stuff around Mira Reed. I alluded to this last week, the R plus L equals J plus M. Mira possibly being John's twin sister, Leia to his Luke. It makes sense that the two survivors from the Tower of Joy would each take a child and raise them as their own and protect them. I think the evidence in the book for this is shaky, but it is a very interesting idea, and in a way it addresses the principal issue people seem to raise with the R plus L equals J theory, the fact that it's too obvious. Maybe Germ added an extra layer of holy shit to the theory once he expanded the series from a trilogy to a heptology or an octology now, and realized he added too much foreshadowing for something that wasn't going to pay off for quite a while. The thing I like most about this idea, what are the colors of Dany's dragons? Black, Drogon, green, Rhaegal, and white, Viserion. Jon Snow and his albino direwolf seem to be like a good fit for Viserion, and Mira would make a good fit for the green, Rhaegal. As for Drogon's rider, everyone is assuming it will be Dany, but what if she is not one of the three riders? Wasn't a prophecy for Rhaegar's children? Rhaenyra is dead, but Aegon lives on, though even that is up for debate, the fact that he's the real Aegon anyway. If Jon and Mira are Rhaegar's children as well, those could be the three riders. Dany is the mother of dragons, but not necessarily a rider, and I think not having her be a rider would neatly subvert our expectations. To this point, she is the only one whom we are certain will be a rider, so it seems right up GRRM's alley to have her be denied. The only thing is, I feel like it's established that she is going to be the rider of Drogon. She's already ridden him even untrained. I feel like that scene in the pit with her and the whip, and then later on her own Dragonstone in the Dothraki Sea. Talked a little bit about this in some tinfoil spoiler sections previously in this season, but I feel like that's kind of established that she's Drogon's rider. Jon plus Mira, though, would neatly fill that out. Anyway, some other Reed-related theories I liked. Reed continues, Jojen is actually Howland Reed. There's some evidence, there's some evidence to support this, the way that Mira is constantly deferring to him, the way he acts like a somber old man, even his nickname is Little Grandfather, etc. Since we only see Jojen through Bran's eyes, it's entirely possible that he is misinterpreting his appearance as younger because of his small size. He thought Jaime and Cersei were basically naked wrestling, so he's a bit of a naive narrator. It's also possible that if Howland is a descendant from the children, that he is more childlike in appearance. I don't like this theory so much because we saw in the show Jojen got pasted by the fireball, and in the book he possibly got pasted as well. I think that Howland would not go out like that, especially without revealing what he knows about Lyanna and the Tower of Joy. And I like the idea that he's the High Septon better. I agree. I can't see him literally being Jojen at all, because yes, we see it through Bran's eyes, but a lot of people see Jojen. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Roderick Castle would surely know one of Ned's bannermen. The Maester would certainly know. I mean, think of all the people that have met the Reeds that were, part of the core Winterfell group, and they would never have seen Howland Reed or be able to recognize him. And is Bran a big enough idiot? I get that maybe he's got childhood forest blood, but he looks like a kid? I don't know. And certainly it seems like the casting from the series played Jojen like he's a straight-up brother of Mira. The next point, though, I like a little bit better. Howland Reed is warging into Jojen and controlling him from time to time or all the time. The same evidence as above also supports this, the way that Mira treats Jojen and Jojen's old manitude, but it is because Howland is just at the wheel. This does not preclude that Howland is the High Septon stuff either. He can be doing both at once. Plus, it's chilling to think that he would use his son, assuming Jojen is actually his son, as a meat suit to guide Bran and then basically dispose of him once the mission is done. In fact, to me, it would suggest that Howland has ulterior motives. Maybe he may be taking the opportunity to screw with Cersei and King's Landing, but being a northerner, maybe he believes that that's what's going on at North is more important. Actually, helping to get Jon Snow on the Iron Throne would serve northern interest. Now you have a king who is intimately aware of the threat the North faces and has a personal stake in protecting the realm from that threat. I like that better, but Howland using his son Jojen is a little bit too far. For someone that's like Ned's ride-or-die boy, that seems a little too cold and calculating for my tastes. Reed continues, saying all that though, how would Stannis feel if Jon Snow became Jon Snark and went off to sit on the Iron Throne? Stannis is not up at the wall out of the goodness of his heart. He's there to protect the realm, sure, but he wants to rule like a king is supposed to. Of course, Stannis may be dead or killed soon, so that might be moot. If he lives, though, it'd be interesting to see what he would do if Jon took the throne from him. And if the whole Jon is Azor Ahai thing is true and Melisandre leaves Stannis to support Jon, that would really leave him in the lurch. I think you're right. I think that Stannis will not survive the next book. And that will... But I also don't think that Jon... You know, I've come around this theory that Jon and Dany are not going to sit the Iron Throne. And in fact, the Iron Throne might not survive the upcoming Long Night 2.0. I think it's entirely likely that the Seven Kingdoms will be back to the Seven Kingdoms. And we'll see... like Rickon ruling the north and, you know, maybe, like I said, Tommen is ruling the south and maybe Myrcella is ruling in Dorne as a foreign princess slash queen. That would be kind of cool. But I feel like the Iron Throne and the fact that this is called Game of Thrones seems to imply that that's going to be a defunct office at the end of this series, that we're not going to get a big happy throne room celebration with Jon and Dany being crowned king and queen or whatever. It's not going to be an all-out sad and horrifying ending because I feel like despite his protestations that George Martin. I'm not doing this George R.R. anymore. George Martin is more of a romantic than he lets on, and we'll get, I think he's described it as a bittersweet ending. We'll get the bittersweet ending where most of the people we care about are dead, but we have enough of the next generation looking like they're not going to fuck things up to kind of pin our hopes on. That's it. That's the final podcast for many, many moons. I'm sad to see it go, but I'm excited for season 5. I hope you all come back and check on us on the off season. I'm going to try really hard to get all of the old Night's Watch edited to remove the Bald Move references per Mad Brew's request and get those uploaded on some neutral site. Best place to follow us to find that is on Twitter at Bald Move. And on Facebook.com/BaldMove, because you follow that, you'll get all of our latest podcast releases, including when I clean that stuff up, if I get a chance to do it. It's a lot of hard work, but it's my intention to use some of the off-season on that. And please join us next spring. We'll have the preview cast, like always, and then right on to the next season. Maybe something a little special if The Winds of Winter comes out. I might do something a little special if it comes out in the meantime. Might do something special if the world of Ice and of A Song of Ice and Fire comes out and it's really good. Might have a special podcast on that. Keep your ears to the ground. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next year.